in association with NintendoWorldReport.com, ChildsPlayCharity.org, and listeners just like you, this is the third annual NWR Live Telethon. On November 10th, the staff at NintendoWorldReport.com and more than a few special guests got together to raise money for Child's Play, an international nonprofit that donates games and consoles to pediatric wards and hospitals. And all the crew was able to raise more than $6,000 thanks to your generous donations. So we're going to be presenting all 9 hours separated into three parts. In this first part, Johnny, James, and Lindy are joined by GiantBomb.com with Brad Shoemaker and Penny Arcade's Jeff Callis to hop aboard the Wii U hype boat. Then in hour two, Guillaume jumps on along with David Ellison 343 and the Podfather himself, Garnett Lee. Finally, our third hour brings in some international flavor as Don Koopman, Carly Young, and Tom Molina get together for the very first Eurocast. Before we begin, I should note that this wasn't recorded in the usual fashion, and as a result, there may be some cutting in and out. That being said, it was an awesome show, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to it just as much as we enjoyed recording it. That's enough out of me. Let's get on to the show.
Okay, guys, let's get started. Welcome to the Nintendo World Report third annual live podcast telethon for Child's Play. I'm trying to make that title a little bit longer every year that we do this, similar to the PAX East panel that we do. I am going to be your host for the first couple hours, and then I'll come back later in the show. My name is Jonathan Metz. Welcome, everyone. Especially those of us who, those of you who have come from other websites, from the Twitterverse, from the social networking. We've had amazing promotional help from lots and lots of different people, and I can't thank them enough. I'll try a little bit later in the show. But first off, I want to finish introducing the cast for our first hour here. This is the Wii U hype train. We are 1 week away from the launch of the Wii U, and with us to help discuss these impending events and lots of other stuff in the world of Nintendo, we've got the return of Mr. John Lindemann.
I'm back again for the first time.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice, John. The John is a regular member of our Radio Free Nintendo podcast, but he's been taking a leave of absence lately. So I was very excited when John told us that he could be here for this telethon because we haven't really heard from him in a while.
Of course, man, I wouldn't miss it.
Oh, it's good to have you, man. We've also got James Jones here.
Hi.
James is the one streaming the audio, so if something goes wrong, it's his fault.
Good.
You just accept the mantle. Good.
We also have
a couple of very special guests. First up, Mr. Brad Shoemaker from Giant Bomb.
I would say moderately special at best.
I think you're very special, Brad.
All right, thank you.
So, I'm excited to have you, man. I mean, I feel like the Giant Bomb guys don't really do other podcasts very often, so I feel really privileged to have you involved here.
Yeah, man, thanks for having me.
I've always liked Brad's opinion on Nintendo stuff from listening to the Bombcast and going back all the way to the GameSpot Hotspot podcast. So I think you're going to be awesome, man. And we've also got our old friend and frequent contributor to the podcast and to the telethon, Mr. Jeff Callis.
Well, hello. Thank you very much. This year I'll try not to reveal some sort of ancient past Nintendo secret that I feel worried about getting in trouble.
Don't get sued.
That's actually our slogan, actually. Don't get sued.
So, Brad and some of the people listening might not know this, but last year we got Jeff to tell – we were doing a segment on the 10-year anniversary of GameCube's launch, and Jeff told a very interesting story about Battlefield 1942 being pitched as a GameCube exclusive.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a build in my desk, like alpha build for years.
We should have put that up as a telethon prize this year.
I had to turn it back in once I left the company.
Okay. Yes. So Jeff is our representative from Penny Arcade. And before we get started here with the Wii U talk, I was hoping, Jeff, you could spend just a minute maybe explaining to people the origins of Child's Play and what exactly this charity is that we're supporting today.
Sure. No problem. Boy, what's been 5 years now? I can't even remember. It's been more than that. Seven? Boy, time flies. So, yeah, back back in the ancient past of internet gaming and all that fun stuff, there was a big media spike about how evil games were and gamers, and it, you know, being a gamer means you're a hooligan and you're going to grow up to be a degenerate. And Mike and Jerry, aka Gabe and Tycho at Penny Arcade, really didn't like the stereotype that was developing. And so they said, let's harness this power for good. And they reached out to, at the time, the local hospital here near our offices, the Seattle Children's Hospital, and made like an Amazon wish list just to, hey, you guys, if you want to contribute. And turned out that our readers, our listeners, and the gaming community at large was very responsive to this and filled Mike Krahulik's garage three times over, really pissed off the Postal Service because they were making
good
4 deliveries to his apartment a day. And they said, oh, I think we've stumbled on something here. This is the chance. One of the things we discovered is that children's hospitals get a lot of stuff for the little kids, but they also treat, you know, teenagers and the tweens, and they don't, there's not a big supply of things to keep them entertained and occupied. And so focusing on a lot of the electronic information or electronic devices kind of became our calling card. And what I think is really interesting now, it's grown, we're 80 plus hospitals, childsplaycharity.org there throughout the URL. You can see the network of hospitals. But what I think is really interesting is with developments like starting with Wii Fit and then, or the balance board and then the Kinect and the Move and then the touchscreen interface, the iPads, a lot of these places have actually adopted this technology as physical therapy. It's not even just entertainment. It's to use that horrible buzzword, gamification. They're not just entertaining and helping them deal with the pain. They're actually helping them recover, which I think is fantastic. So there we go. There's the 45-second nutshell.
No, that's great. I mean, it just cues me up for this appeal that I'll make. We'll probably make it once or twice every hour, but the whole point of doing this is to raise money for Child's Play. I mean, as Jeff just described, it's a really fantastic charity, and I know it means a lot to a lot of kids. And we've heard from alumni of that charity who, you know, had things provided by Child's Play, and they told us how much it meant to them. So it really is a great thing, and that's why we're supporting it. And so if you're within the sound of my voice right now, I really hope you will go to the page and try to make a donation if you're able to. And if not, you're helping just by being a part of this event and participating in the chat and calling in a little bit later. So, by the way, we are going to be taking live calls at the end of this hour, pretty much at the end of every hour, sometimes maybe throughout the whole hour, depending on the segment. And if you're interested in doing that, just send a request to Carl on Skype. And he will sort of filter through that, figure out who's going to be first, who's going to go in what order. Actually, if you go to the chat room, that's the best way to find out how to do that. So just let him know, and he'll post something in there. It's nothing urgent right now because it's going to be a little while before we get to it, but I just wanted to throw that out there. And by the way, for a donation update, we're currently starting the show at 51%, over $2,000 raised already, which is absolutely fabulous. So thanks everybody who already donated. A lot of people do it early just to get it out of the way and to help us get hyped for the event. But if you've been holding off for the live show, now would be a good time to go ahead and kick it in. And I know we're going to have people joining throughout the day based on time zones and such. So we're gonna be hearing from more people and seeing donations throughout the day. So thanks everybody for doing that. Please don't forget about it. By the way, Carl's Skype ID is carl.castaneda. That is carl.castaneda. And you can send him a message on Skype if you want to call in a little bit later. But again, it's probably easier to go in the chat room. That way you get the spelling right and everything. So let's kick off this Wii U discussion, guys. It's 1 week out, and I wanted to have John on here because we haven't heard from him in a while about Wii U. But actually, the first person I want to start with is Brad, because Brad, I believe you guys have one in the office. I don't know how much you can talk about it.
I'm actually holding the controller in my hands right now.
Whoa.
Look at me. Look at me, big special guy with the Wii U.
Oh, my gosh.
This got real.
So did you take it home to do some review?
Yeah, I brought the office one home for the weekend. I'm going to be reviewing a couple of the games. So it's been pretty interesting. I've only had it in the house for like maybe 8-10 hours. Just brought it home last night. And some of the most interesting stuff so far has been messing with like how far the controller can go. You know, will it go through walls and stuff like that? It was this weird moment last night of getting home kind of too late to want to dig behind the TV and pull out cables to hook it up to the TV. So I just went in the bedroom and plugged it into the wall and like stuck it under a chair and just laid in bed and played Mario on the controller without even like involving a TV in the equation at all. It was actually a pretty cool thing.
You didn't even connect it to a TV?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it looks, I think I can talk about this stuff. I hope I'm not overstepping my bounds here.
It's for charity.
Go ahead. Talk about, reveal those.
It's for the kids, right? But yeah, I mean, it looks good enough on that screen that that I really didn't feel like I was missing out on anything by not having a TV in front of me.
Yeah, I think, you know, from playing Mario at a couple of E3s now and a couple of other events, I do feel like you really don't lose that much. I feel like the gamepad screen is a little bit less vibrant than most TVs in terms of the color saturation, but it really looks. It doesn't look low res, and I think it's partly just because the gamepad screen is smaller and closer to you, so the pixels are more dense, and it ends up being a more or less equivalent experience to looking at a big screen TV that's across the room, and so you just really don't notice it that much. And it's still a pretty good screen. It's not a giant Vita screen or anything like that, but you know.
Yeah, I was able to see just a little bit of aliasing here and there. A couple of compression artifacts. I don't know how they're handling the video over the wireless.
If the Iwata Ask is kind of mind-bending when you read about the stuff they went through for video compression.
It seems kind of un-Nintendo-like to even be out there talking about like technical stuff like that. You know, like, I feel like they've always put forth the impression that like there's, you know, pixie dust and unicorns running around inside their consoles.
Yeah, well, in the past, we've never really been given access to the technical people who work on that stuff and are actually qualified to discuss it. But now with Iwata Asks, they've taken the press out of the loop. And so they go a little bit deeper in the roster to talk to some of these people.
Right, Iwata is best journalist.
He's best ever.
He's stealing our jobs, man. So that's awesome. I imagine you're very limited, but so I'm not going to ask you to keep on talking about your current experiences, but I'm sure it'll give you a nice perspective on some of these questions that I've sort of drafted up to guide our discussion. So maybe first off, we could talk about the hype level. I mean, this is the Wii U hype train segment, and with 1 week out, you know, I'm usually fairly stoic and removed about the gaming industry. I've been doing it for so long that I don't get really crazy, just riled up about anything anymore. But a new Nintendo console launch is a big deal because this is the one platform that I do buy on launch day. And it's such a childhood tradition, you know, going back through my whole life of getting really excited when a new Nintendo system comes out, all the way back to at least Super Nintendo. So I imagine a lot of our listeners and a lot of you guys feel the same way. And I wanted to ask, like, a week out, how hyped up are we really? You know, Brad might be a little exempt from this since he already has been, but
I'm satisfied.
but John, you know, you having been out of the action for a few weeks now, we haven't really heard from you. Are you planning to get a Wii U at launch? Are you super psyched for it right now?
I'm pretty psyched for it. I won't be getting one at launch just for fundage issues. That's the thing. I mean, for me, it's like I've known that for a while. I knew that I wouldn't be able to drop, you know, $400 plus on it.
Are you actively suppressing hype?
I've been keeping tabs on it. You know how you know when you have something pre-ordered and you know it's coming, you just grab every piece of info you can find, you know. But I've been kind of keeping tabs on it, sort of following it in the back of my mind. I've been like, well, you know, I can't get it at launch anyway, so you know, I'm just going to keep tabs and kind of see what's going on. But yeah. It's like when I see things, you know, like Monster Hunter stuff like that. I think that's kind of my target. Is when they release Monster Hunter Ultimate. That's kind of what I'm looking at. Eventually, I think it'll be like the 3DS where it's always in the back of my mind. Eventually, I will cave. It's just a matter of time. It's like in my mind, I know at some point it's going to happen. So, yeah, but I'm pretty psyched for it. I mean, it's very good. It feels like the launch to me though, just because there isn't, it's not going head to head with any other console launch. I feel like it's a little bit subdued in terms of, you know, fanboy rage out there on the internet. I mean,
rage?
Certainly you have the Nintendo haters, but you know, I think, you know, when you see, you know, next year or whenever the next, you know, Sony and Microsoft consoles are launched, that's when you'll see the real fanboy rage. But now it's just to me it feels like it's
They have no ammo yet?
Exactly. Well, I feel like everybody right now that if you're kind of a Nintendo hater, you're just kind of occupied with like whatever Halo 4 or Black Ops 2 or something like that.
Oh,
and I feel
true.
Like this launch, I think it's kind of cool that this launch is sort of it feels like it's sort of like the Nintendo fans' own launch. Like nobody else is kind of trying to, you know, stamp out the hype sort of thing. So I like that.
Awesome. And Jeff, how are you feeling about this as a former Nintendo employee? I imagine you've gone through a console launch before. Were you there at the beginning of GameCube?
Yes. Well, yeah, because we transitioned Eternal Darkness from N64 to GameCube. So
oh,
I worked
right.
at Nintendo during the launch of the N64, the Virtual Boy, the Game Boy Color, the DS, GameCube. I'm sure there's a few things in there that I'm missing. So I guess I could best qualify my hype level as morbid curiosity. It's you know, personally, I'm not that excited for it. It's a curiosity purchase for me. I'm actually really curious in its non-gaming applications, like the gadget aspects of it, like the being able to stream television. Of course, I can do that now with the Sling Box, so it's not doing anything new. But just as a tech guy, I kind of like that. I am actually interested in it. I have a 5-year-old boy, and I'm really getting him into the video games. And anything that lets us work together, and a lot of the games are going to have that cooperation. Someone's got the controller, someone's using the television. Those
yeah, it seems
sort
really
of
built for those kind of experiences.
Exactly, and that's what I'm more excited about is just being able to have gaming opportunities with my son. But in terms of hype level, you know, I'll swing by a couple stores and see if I can pick one up. I didn't pre-order. I'll go to one of these, you know, department stores that doesn't take pre-orders and see if they've got a couple lying in back because gamers forget they sell things.
Oh, yeah, like Target.
Yeah, Fred Meyer, I find I get everything launched without any hassle. Not that I'm shilling for Fred Meyer, but...
It wouldn't matter if you were. They're really on the West Coast only.
Yeah, they're. I figure they were a limited franchise, but yeah, it's just from a curiosity aspect. Nintendo's always been really good at. Oh, we took a beating over these issues. The next hardware is going to try to address a bunch of these, but man, they really do go off to the beat of their own drummer, don't they? And it's very different. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in one sense, I wish it was maybe a little more of a technological leap in terms of graphics, you know, sound. But I think the choices they're making in terms of control and interface and stream, you know, trying to change the experience of what you actually do when you play the games. I'll say, I mean, they've done this before, of course, with Wii, but I do kind of feel like the approach this time is a little more exciting for me just because motion control is this very kind of ambiguous. Does it work? Does it not work? Do I really want to do this? I mean, just because it's new, that doesn't make it good. And, you know, motion control ended up kind of being a mixed bag over the next few years. It was really good for some things, and it ruined some games, and a lot of people just never figured out how to use it. But the experience they're doing with the gamepad this time around feels like, you know, they're doing something that is certainly a little more appealing to me. Not necessarily in the local multiplayer aspect, but just the experience, you know, especially some of the stuff you see with Zombie U, a single player game that uses both screens. I think that's really interesting. It takes some of the original concepts from Nintendo DS when, you know, even before, this was back in, 2003, or in early 2004, before we knew there was a touchscreen on the DS. You knew, Jeff, but most of us didn't know. And
I think it's funny that I feel like this is Game Boy Advance Connect to the next level.
Yeah, there's some of that, but I mean, even back then, with the whole, you know, GameCube GBA connectivity, most people felt like it was actually a pretty cool idea for a few games. And the biggest problem was the implementation and just the amount of hardware needed. You know, so I think it's interesting that they're making that concept such a centerpiece of this new console, but I do take some comfort in the fact that it's not the only thing that they're focusing on. You know, it's not that they're putting all their chips on that square. They're, you know, it's just one of the really cool ideas and the things that they're doing with it. So James, we've heard from you fairly recently about your hype level. I just wanted to get a quick update. Is it cranking up?
So I've gone from originally saying I'll wait, mostly because I was one of the idiots who got a 3DS at the very, very beginning and then realized there was absolutely no games to play for it on launch day except for one Pilot Wings game that lasted an hour. it's not terribly inaccurate, to be honest. I've gone from that to missing the pre-order window for most stores to putting my name on a list to get a phone call when one is available to then trying to go to multiple Walmarts on the same day to try to take advantage of their stealth pre-orders.
How the mighty have fallen, James.
Well, to be fair, I haven't been successful, so just now I'm more just pandering. I'm basically just – I'm out on the street corner at this point. It's not good.
Yeah.
It's not a good feeling.
Well, I always thought you'd wind up there for the record.
What was that?
Will work for Wii U.
No, that's right. I will. There we go. I think, like I said when we discussed it before, it's just that it's been so long since we've had any console launch that I'm just sort of ready for it at this point.
6 years.
Yeah.
Since any console launched.
I don't know if it would even matter what manufacturer it was. I would at least be morbidly interested in this point.
I mean,
it's just been a while.
I feel like it's interesting because even though it has been so long and there's clearly a market for people who just are hungry for any new hardware, you know, even if it doesn't seem like a massive leap over the current status quo with the HD consoles, it does feel like there's a – you know, I think a lot of people are curious about Wii U just like Jeff said, but it does feel like there's a lack of feeling like we're entering a new era here. I mean, it feels like because the other two systems are coming out probably next fall, it feels like a lot of people are sort of holding back on that feeling that we're all shifting forward a little bit and that we're entering a new age. I think that's a little unfair because I think Wii U is going to be a new age, maybe a parallel, generation to what's going on with Sony and Microsoft. But it does feel like a pretty major step forward, and certainly for us Nintendo fans, it's going to be a massive upgrade from Wii, which was always a little underpowered and a little disappointing in that regard. So I'm really excited. You know, I've got my system pre-ordered, and so I'm going to be there next Saturday night to pick it up at midnight. But you know, I think about, am I more excited for the system or for the games? And I wanted to kind of ping you guys on that topic because the lineup is certainly very broad. A lot of it is stuff that we've seen on other systems before, so it may or may not be new to you as a Nintendo fan or as a new owner of the system. But, you know, you can't argue with the number of games, and a lot of them either look to be really good or we already know they're really good because they've been out on other systems. And yet it doesn't feel like people are really hyped up on the software itself. It seems like people want the system and they're – you know, even the people who are already committed to buying the system early on are mainly buying it for the potential of what's coming later. I mean, do you guys think that's true, or do you have a little bit different perspective on it?
I think it's it's definitely feeling that way for us. I mean, I sat down with Jeff, Jeff Gerstmann this week. We were just kind of looking at the list of what's coming out and saying, all right, like, what do we really need to drill down on? What needs to get a review and full video coverage and stuff? And it was like three or four games off this list that are like really the tentpole releases that we haven't seen on other systems. So even though the list is long, I don't feel like there's a lot of marquee titles coming on day one with this thing.
And Brad, I mean, Giant Bomb is, of course, really focused on video content. Are you guys struggling with a bunch of stipulations from Nintendo on how you're supposed to video the system?
They've actually been pretty cool about. So back in the day, like we would get the custom capture hardware for the DS, like a big fat, like rugged metal box that would spit out, you know, two video feeds and stuff. And back then they were really strict about. Rules like, you know, both screens have to be displayed in the video window at all times. You can't, like, scale just one of them up and cut the other one out. So I was expecting stuff like that this time, but they haven't said anything like, you know, you must always show what's on the controller in a picture-in-picture or anything like that. So they're being pretty cool about that stuff. They have pretty serious constraints on how much of the games we can show right now, though, so...
Sure, but that's typical embargo stuff.
Yeah,
right?
that's standard boilerplate stuff. So we ran our first quick look of a Wii U game this week, and for that one we just set a camera up over the shoulder so you could see what was happening on the controller. It seems to work well enough for now. Hopefully, we'll come up with a more formal solution in the future, but it's working okay so far.
How do you feel about your first Wii U quick look being tank, tank, tank?
I think it could not have been more appropriate.
Really?
For a whole bunch of different reasons. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, you know, we've been doing this for a real long time. And it seems like every new console that comes out, every new system, the first game you see on it is just like some weird, obscure, off-the-wall thing. Like the first PSP game I ever saw was Sticky Balls, and it was in some questionable hotel suite in Tokyo. Like Full Auto was the first 360 game I ever saw. You know, it's like it's never the new Super Mario Brothers U that you see to kick off a system like that. You know, it's always some weird third party thing.
Yeah, Pink Pals for DS.
Yeah, exactly.
Pals. Oh Jesus. Okay. John, what about you? Are you at this point? Are you more excited about the system itself, the hardware, all the crazy features, and the online stuff that it's doing, or? Is there like launch window software that has you really pumped up and you think is like, you know, is effectively a system seller or at least a collective system seller?
I mean, I think the launch window software is good. I mean, it's certainly broad. But really I'm waiting for, you know, the big franchises to come in. You know, I'm of course really hyped up about Monster Hunter with the crossplay with 3DS, Monster Hunter Ultimate. So
you can buy two copies of a game you've already played.
Hey, why not? I've done it before, you know. Why not? I've done it, you know, three different times, you know. I just wish it was coming out on PC so I could buy it on PC as well and then never play it. That'd be my favorite. that's what I tend to do. Just to say I had it, you know, just in case I lose every other console and I just have my PC, I'm set. But I'm really waiting for, you know, I want to see what they do with some of the real marquee franchises. You know, I want to see Metroid on it, definitely. Something, you know, because Retro is supposedly working on something that, you know, everybody wants us to work on. So I'm hoping that's some sort of continuation of Metroid Prime.
Yeah, more on that next hour.
Yeah, I'm more curious about what's coming in the future and kind of what they're going to do with the gamepad. Because I can tell you that when I do get a Wii U, I think I'm going to fall in love with the gamepad and what you can do. I mean, like what Brad was talking about, like just being able to, you know, turn off the console or whatever and just play a game, you know, just kind of move seamlessly between the gamepad and your TV or monitor. I think it's going to be really, really cool.
Yeah. Jeff, maybe you can give some perspective on this, but one thing we talked about a couple weeks ago is how I think Nintendo's really done a disservice to the anticipation for Wii U and for the general understanding of what the system really does, because the way the demos have been given to press and even to public with this kind of traveling show that they're doing is so different from the way you would play it in your home. And this is every publisher deals with this, I think. But the idea that, you know, whenever you go to some event and you play Wii U up to now, it's been you're standing 3 feet in front of a TV holding a gamepad that's tethered to the system and may or may not be transmitting video over a wire. And this is so different from the way you actually use the system in your home that I feel like I know I, and I think probably a lot of other people, really haven't begun to appreciate just how awesome this technology is and how it changes the way that you sort of sit in your living room and interact with a video game.
Yeah, they've always kind of struggled with that, no matter what the hardware has been. It's been, you know, with the Wii, how do they show motion working with, you know, because it used to be just straight video streams as here's our games. They've always been really good at creating hardware that had potential that at launch is very difficult to wrap your heads around. And it usually takes a second generation of software for people to go, oh, that's really cool. Wii was a little different just because it came with Wii Sports. So it was really easy to pick up and play. And you got it. But yeah, they've always struggled. I remember with the DS launch, how do we show two screens? How do we show someone touching those two screens without still seeing what's on the screen?
Yeah.
And even then, a lot of the software didn't even know how to use touch or two screens. I remember talking to Jerry, Tyco, right after they showed the original DS, and they panned it. They hated it. They thought it was a horrible piece of hardware. And now he doesn't go anywhere without it.
Well, that old E3 2004 prototype hardware was really bad.
Yeah, exactly. And I kind of – it's the Wii U presentation hasn't been as bad, but it hasn't been over the moon great either. And so it's – you know, and plus maybe it's just a sign of – we've all mentioned, oh, we've been doing this forever – We're all kind of in a position where we just, show me. Sit back, wait, show me. I've yet to see anything, or I have yet to hear from someone I trust what is the must play. Like, I have not, no one's, there hasn't been a chance for word of mouth yet because it hasn't launched.
Right.
And that's where I base most of my purchase decisions is these people who I trust their opinion tell me I need to play this game. Well, when they tell me this is the game I have to play, that's when I go out and buy it.
And Brad, I'm not going to ask you to name names, but do you think there will be a must play from what you've seen?
This is where I feel like I might have to be careful about how much I say. I mean, you know, new Super Mario seems like the natural kind of day one, right? Right. You know, I mean, it's got all kinds of party features and, I should probably stop, actually. I played enough of it now that I think I may have to defer to the embargo.
Sure.
On that one.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, in a sense, like, we can complain about how maybe there isn't a really obvious system seller. There's no Mario 64 here. There's not even a Wii Sports, which is probably the ultimate system seller. I guess that should be the new go-to name drop. But you know, considering the supply constraints and the amount of name recognition and demand that they're going to have, they're going to sell all these systems anyway. And so maybe the age of needing a system seller, you know, needing that word of mouth game that everybody freaks out about and just absolutely has to have has been, I think you still need that, but maybe it's now two or three games rather than just one. And maybe you need it later. Maybe you need it 6 months after launch, or maybe you need it 1 year after launch. Because up till then, you're probably not going to have a problem selling the system. I mean, I guess Vita would be a counterexample to this. But at least for Nintendo, that has pretty much proven to be true. You know, the 3DS, well, a little bit different situation with the price on 3DS. But, you know. So, quick donation update, guys. We are up to 3%, $21.35 right now, which is great. And we have a lot of telethon left to go. We're going to be getting ready to do live calls here in another 10 minutes or so. So if you want to, if you have a question for us, if you have something you want to say about one of the topics that we brought up this hour, please send a request to Carl. He will remind you in the chat room what that is here in a few seconds once the lag catches up. And he will queue a few people up and get them patched into our call here so you can talk to us. And just a reminder that next hour we have the Metroid Prime segment. We're going to be talking with Garnet Lee and David Ellis and a few other people about the sort of the history of Metroid Prime and maybe the future of it as well. I actually played a little bit of it last night to get ready for it, so I'm super psyched about that. But back to the Wii U, what do you guys think is the single most exciting thing about this system and maybe the single greatest concern? James, I'm curious to hear. I mean, you're a real expert. You know, you talk, you know, you and I talk about this stuff pretty much every week. After covering, I mean, we've been talking about the system for over 2 years now, even before we knew what the name of it was. After all that, after having played it now for yourself, after seeing all these demos, what do you think in the end is the single greatest thing the system has going for it?
Single greatest thing the system has going for it? I think I mean, for me, it's what I'm most excited about for the system, which is, you know, I've played it. I missed E3 2012, but I played it at E3 2011. I've played it at demo events. You know, I've even played it at store things.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've never really gotten the full experience of is getting it in a situation in your home with other people to play that sort of asynchronous gameplay thing they were really pushing at both the E3s it's been at, and seeing people interact with each other as they play the game, seeing people get excited who've never played the system before, or that same thing that happened the first time, you know, you brought a Wii into a house where no one had seen it before. It was kind of an exciting experience. But just getting to see that gameplay style at home where really get people together to play games, because they haven't had to do that a lot lately, or haven't had the chance to a lot lately. For me, that's what's more exciting, and I haven't gotten a chance to do it, because really playing it, you know, for 5 minutes in the deafening echo chamber that is E3 with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal who only plays, you know, like Bejeweled. It's not really the full experience, I gotta say. So,
fair enough. John, what about you? I mean, you've spoken a lot about the online features and, you know, you're always anxious about what Nintendo's going to do with them. We just learned a little bit more about it, maybe not full disclosure of what's going on with the Wii U's online features, but how do you feel about it? Do you think they're headed in the right direction? You think it's going to be enough? And is that the thing that excites you the most?
You know, that excites me. I mean, I think they're definitely, you know, kind of making the right moves with the online stuff that they're integrating into the console. But I also like the fact that they're actually consciously going out and trying to get a broad range of types of games for it. I mean, the fact that it has Black Ops 2 at launch is a big deal. And I think a lot of people are kind of, you know, overlooking that because, you know, in the past, I mean, if you were a first-person shooter fan, Nintendo, forget about it. I mean, most of the first-person shooters just, like, weren't as good as they were on 360 or PS3. And kind of bringing a Nintendo console sort of into the fold kind of thing with the broad range of games that are out there, very popular genres, I think that's kind of the biggest thing I'm looking forward to. It's like it's when you talk about first-person shooters – you can now talk about a Nintendo console, you know, in that, in, you know, you can
without,
now talk about
like
it.
Giant fucking asterisk by it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's what.
Without it being Reflux Edition.
Yep.
Yeah. So. I think Call of Duty is a really great example of what the system might mean, because not only is it important for console parity, you know, for the people who buy this new system to not feel like they're missing out on the big games that are coming out on the other systems at the same time. But I think there's a potential for Black Ops 2 on Wii U to actually be the best version of that game. And that's not something that we've had on a Nintendo console from third parties in a long time. Like Soul Calibur 2. I don't know what the last, you know, really great example of that is. But
yeah, I mean, also what I'm seeing is, you know, among our staff, I've already seen, you know, some email threads pop up where they're like, you know what, I might just try Black Ops 2 just to check it out, because, you know, a lot of people are going to play it and it's kind of a fun game to play with friends sort of thing. So I think you'll see probably some Nintendo fans maybe actually start experiencing first-person shooters when before they didn't really care about them, but and they didn't really have a chance to really play, many of them anyways, or at least the top shelf first person shooter experience. So
the biggest revelation there is that John reads staff email.
I do. I get tons of them still. I try to avoid it.
Jeff, what do you think? What's like the one thing? I mean, in a system that's really this kind of chimera of so many different features and so many different ways to play it, and you've even seen Nintendo be, you know, really sort of unsure about the best way to present this and explain it to people. You know, I think the nine chambered, you know, Hollywood Squares sort of set up for their ad is really kind of a great visual depiction of the difficulty in describing this thing. What do you think is the one thing that really pokes out that's going to be the, you know, kind of the thing that it either lives or dies by?
The fact it has an HDMI out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
say that tongue in cheek, but in some seriousness, it's the fact that they've tried to design this thing to help. They're bending. They're being a little more flexible. They're giving the consumers what they've been asking for, and that's exciting to me. I just the fact that they've never once really competed on a technical level, at least when it came to a home console. The portable, they've always been way ahead, but that to me. It's for the most part, the software is not going to look a generation and a half behind everyone else.
Yeah, I think not just a big part of it seeing the Nintendo franchises in HD. You know, seeing Mario in HD is maybe not it's not what that franchise really needed. You know, it's not going to fix that franchise. It's not going to make it 100 times better than it was before, but it is going to be really nice. And seeing what Nintendo's artists can do with this new level of visual fidelity, I'm pretty excited by it. And especially when you get into the franchises that have a little more detail, you know, things like Metroid and Star Fox and Zelda, where you're not as zoomed out maybe from the view as you are with some of this early stuff that we're seeing.
Yeah, what that it does is it makes
that's
it
really exciting.
Yeah, it makes it so, I mean, it always used to be the negative comment. Oh, you know, it's on Nintendo, but it doesn't look as good. Now, while it's not a positive bullet point, what it does is it eliminates a negative bullet point.
Yeah.
And I think anything that you can do on the mass market where you eliminate these, well, it doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
You're setting yourself up a little bit for better success.
Yeah. Okay. So, Brad, I don't know. Again, you might be kind of limited into what you can say here, but what do you feel like is the one feature that Nintendo really should be hyping that really screams out to you as being the most exciting thing that maybe it's something people don't know about, or maybe it's just something people haven't fully appreciated yet?
I would like to say, you know, the integration of the screen on the controller and stuff, but I'm not sure if they have the applications for it yet there to show people yet. You know, I don't know if they can necessarily point to a specific use case for this thing and say, this is why you need this controller with a big crazy screen in it. You know, some of the games that they're putting out at launch, you're just getting the same action on the screen as you are in the TV, which, you know, as I mentioned earlier, is great if you want to lay in bed and play the game. But like, you remember when they first showed the controller 2 E3s ago, and they're like, you know, they're playing golf with a ball on the screen on the floor and all kinds of weird stuff like that. I don't know if those applications are there yet. But, you know, if they were, that would be the thing that I would say they should be out there kind of pitching to people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that's kind of when they, you know, even when we first heard the rumors of what this thing was going to be, even before they had shown it last year, we were talking about some of the concepts. And again, I go back to, like, you know, the original soccer game description that they used for the DS hardware when they first announced it. And it feels like there are so many cool things you can do with having two different screens and going back and forth between them, but they haven't shown that too much. I mean, Nintendo Land, as much as a showcase as it is for a lot of features on the system, it doesn't really do that because it's meant to be played multiplayer. So you have, you know, one person has the screen, the other people can't see it, and a lot of the interactivity that they're building is around that idea. But I think the idea of having one screen that's closer to you that shows something different than what you see on the screen is really exciting. And, you know, what we've seen so far is, you know, probably mostly sort of a map or a radar kind of functionality to it, which I'm not saying isn't useful, but it's probably not the sexiest use you could think of for...
It's the kind of use on the DS that we used to go, oh, it's just a map down there.
Yeah. And you know, not to take anything away from that, because in games like the Castlevania games, for instance, on DS, it's really, really helpful. But it seems like you could... You know, you could do something a lot more creative and exciting with it. So I think going forward, you know, Zombie U is probably the best example so far of what the potential is for that feature. And you know, I think there's a lot more to be done there. And I'm surprised Nintendo hasn't shown better usage of it. Even like with Pikmin 3, playing at E3 this year, I was not all that impressed with what they were doing with the system. I mean, I was excited that there's a new Pikmin and it looks really great, but what are you doing that I haven't seen before? Not, you know, not really anything so far. So I'm hoping when they come back and they re-unveil that game that they show a little bit more innovation with how they're using the controller and how they're using the system. All right, guys. Well, let's get into some live listener calls. I think we have people queued up here, and let me notify. Let me notify Carl here in the chat. So ask everybody to be a little bit patient here. This is sort of a complex process getting people put in here, but it has worked pretty well in the past. So we are calling Luca right now. And
go.
I think he just needs to pick up. That's probably a good reminder for everybody. If you are talking to Carl, if you're queued up to come in,
stay at your computer.
Stay at your computer. Make sure you have Skype open and make sure you are ready to answer a call if you get it. Okay, so we're probably going to move on to the next person here.
Hello.
Oh, hey, there's Luca.
Here I am. I'm sorry, I've just installed Skype on my PC and I didn't remember how it worked.
That's okay.
Yeah, but Luca, you're a veteran of calling into these live shows.
Yes, indeed. I'm happy to see you remember. I was the very first caller.
We're maintaining a tradition here. And can you remind us where you're calling from, Luca?
I'm calling from Italy, and I'm currently laughing inside myself at your Skype picture. It's really amazing.
Yeah, I took the goofiest one that I could.
It's deeply haunting.
So, Luca,
I won't sleep anyway. I won't sleep tonight anyway.
And Luca, did you have a question for the group here?
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the way Nintendo is communicating nowadays, because we witnessed them change so much over the years, from Space World to Reggie, from the E3 2006, which was grand, to the downscaling of E3, and now with Iwata Asks, and the information dropped in little bits here and there.
It's direct.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So I wanted to know, what do you think? Is it better or worse?
Mm. It's better if you're Nintendo. Yeah, control the feed.
They really control what they're saying and what they leak out to the press now. I mean, they control that message.
Yeah. Really, I mean, they're not exclusive in this. Lots of companies are using social media as their primary or one of their means of communication with the broader public, and not just sending out press releases that are long and dry and may or may not be riddled with things that we're not particularly interested in. It's a much more effective means of communicating directly with your audience, because you know, when we're talking to press contacts, we're not the person that they really are trying to get info to. They're trying to get it to the people we disseminate. So if they can disseminate themselves, obviously it's a bigger advantage. Nintendo's just taken this a step further and decided to put Iwata in front of a camera at random intervals that they don't announce ahead of time.
Yeah, it's really strange to see the president of Nintendo out there so much. I mean, you compare him to Hiroshi Yamauchi before.
Yeah.
I just can't even imagine. I think Iwata's hilarious and adorable, and a very, very smart guy. I think the interviews that he does are valuable in, you know, for Iwata asks, in that he really knows the questions to ask these guys because he's so intimate with it. But at the same time, he's not necessarily a good advocate for the fans. You know, he's not necessarily asking the questions that they want answered. And I think that's where the press could do a better job, or could do a different job. But in terms of Nintendo controlling the message, I'd say they've always controlled their message. In the past, their method has been to just not have a message, you know, to just not say anything until they would release information, these giant dumps. You know, they put out these press kits during E3 with information on games that they've never announced before. And suddenly,
which they did this year too, to be honest.
Yeah, they still do that, and it's really bad. I wish they wouldn't do it that way. But, you know, in the past, it was like you'd only hear anything from Nintendo about twice a year, and it made it just horrible to be a Nintendo fan to try to – I mean, that's why we learned to live in our imaginations and speculations a lot, because there was so little drip from Nintendo. And I think, you know, they're controlling the message now in just a different way, and that they actually are releasing it themselves, and they're doing it much more frequently. So – I wish that we still had more access as, you know, Nintendo-focused media, enthusiast media, even multi-platform media. I wish they had more chances to talk to these developers. We probably have less chances now. Nintendo hardly schedules any developer interviews at E3, for instance, because they've got a lot of asks that they can, you know, do ahead of time and then just release whenever they want to. But for the most part, I think it's good. We're getting more insight into what they're doing. They're talking to us more often. It gives them better opportunities to announce games and market them, even when they're off cycle. So I think we're going to avoid, you know, situations like Excitebots, which was released with absolutely no pre-release attention whatsoever. I think Nintendo Direct and Iwata Ask and some of these, you know, the direct video access that they have to your systems now is an improvement on that. And I hope it helps them get the word out a little bit better. But I still wish they would talk to us a little more directly and talk
to us. I feel like we get more news up front, but there's less unexpected news. So it's kind of, you know, so that goes back to the hype train. The hype train is a little bit, you know, a little bit slower than it was, just because
it's like a hype boat.
Yeah, it's like a hype boat. Like, you feel like you know a lot, and like, we knew a lot really early about Wii U, and they have filled in some of the blanks, but maybe not all of them entirely. So
yeah.
Okay, sorry, Jeff and Brad, that was kind of a like hardcore Nintendo media question.
No, I was just thinking that I'm still afraid to talk to press.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add to that is that as long as they're not out there on Facebook saying, like this page a zillion times before we tell you anything, then I think they're doing it.
God.
And they do a pretty good job of avoiding countdown timers, which is one of my pet peeves in game marketing. So that's a good thing. Well, Luca, thanks so much for your question. Thanks for calling in, man.
Thank you for having me. And just one final thought. You guys are talking about Wii U test units in your GameStop, and I wanted to tell you what my local GameStop has. It has a giant sticker on its glass door that says, "We've tried Wii U, ask us about it." And that is it. And we know the GameStop employees are the best source of information lately.
Marketing!
All right, thanks, man. So we're going to move on now to Zed.
Hello?
Hey, Zed.
Hey. Hi, guys. What's up?
Hey, man.
Hey, man. How you doing?
So thanks for calling. Did you have a question for the group?
Yeah. I was just kind of interested in what your thoughts would be. Obviously, new generation starting with Wii U. And, you know, a new generation is generally a good idea to bring a new IP into the fold. And, you know, we saw this quite a lot with the last generation on PS3 and 360. And, you know, a bunch of IPs were spawned from that. I was wondering what you guys thought about Nintendo starting a new IP, what kind of genre of game you'd like to see it be, and which development studio, you know, first-party developer would you like to see developing it?
Ooh.
How about a diamond smuggling simulator?
I think that niche has been filled.
Yeah, I mean, that's one I would really like to see. I mean, I guess, you know, Pikmin 3 would sort of be this, but, you know, I think that there's definitely more that they can do with, you know, kind of the RTS genre. Something maybe more, you know, more like you know, StarCraft-ish or something like that. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Well, with that interface, certainly, yeah, it's more conducive to being a console experience now than it has been previously. I mean,
yep.
Well, it so happens we have an RTS expert on the call right now. Brad, can you imagine a Wii U game, you know, like an RTS that you would want to play? I mean, do you think that interface is something that you could adapt for some kind of really exciting high-level play? Maybe not approaching StarCraft II, but right, in that vein?
I mean, if you're talking about, excuse me, something that would be as technical and competitive as like an eSport, like a StarCraft kind of thing, I don't think that it's up to the task. I mean, the screen is basically, you know, it's a giant DS touch screen. It's not iPad level with multi-touch. You know, it's just you're only getting one input on that screen at a time. So I feel like the potential for that kind of stuff might be a little limited, but that's just my gut reaction.
A mouse interface on PC is single input as well.
Well, true, but you get a lot more precision and a lot, you know, a lot faster. Or, you know, it's a little more twitchy, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone through a few of the RTSs on like 360 and just, you know, some of them work out fine, but in general, I just didn't like having to try to move the cursor around, especially in the high, when it was a higher view out with the stick and try to get exactly where I wanted to get. But a lot of the games have to be built for being console experiences. And if you do that, I think, you know, any of the systems could work in theory. But certainly that would be something I would be interested in, but more I would expect it to not be esports style RTS gameplay, no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think another genre is the sort of the space flight sim. You know, I grew up obsessed with TIE Fighter, and we've seen that new game from the Wing Commander guy is, you know, coming out in a couple of years. And it seems like he's really focusing on PC, but he's not ruling out console for that game. And I feel like that kind of game could work really nicely on the Wii U because the gamepad gives you a direct interface to do a lot of the management that those spaceflight sims are involved with. You know, you're shuffling power around to different engines and shields and weapon systems. You're looking at radar, and it's a three-dimensional space, so you have this kind of complex map/radar system. And being able to pull that off the screen so that on the screen you can really focus on what you would see and focus on the action aspect of it and keep the simulation part down on the bottom, that's very appealing to me. And I think that's a kind of system that you can't even directly reproduce on the PC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just going to say that, like, that's real. It's really, you know, when you're flying a plane, I mean, you would actually be sitting there with, you know, joysticks, and then you'd take your hand off one thing and, you know, switch something on, switch something off. So it'd be very realistic for that type of thing.
Yeah.
Something that I'm really excited about is, I mean, new IPs are great, of course, but I'm actually really interested to see if they take any hard left turns with a lot of their existing kind of storied franchises this time. You know, I mean, like with Skyward Sword coming out, the consensus seemed to be that, you know, the Zelda franchise has kind of stagnated a little bit. So, you know, do they make as bold a move as, like, say, giving a Zelda game to a Western team or something like that? You know, it seems like now's the time, now that this hardware is here, for them to really kind of take some gambles with the stuff that people are really used to.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Obviously, Mario was not the candidate they picked for that.
Definitely not.
Yeah, but we will see a 3D Mario on this system. And
I would hope so.
It's much more innovative than the new Super Mario team. So I am pretty curious to see what they do with it. And I have a lot of confidence in them to pull it off. So, Zed, thanks for the call, man. Really appreciate
it. Thanks a lot, guys. I started listening to the show and following the site about 2 years ago to the day because the first time you did the telethon, that was when I kind of started listening in and stuff. So it's kind of a bit of an anniversary here. So it's been great.
Awesome. That's great, okay, man. So good to have you on. Thanks.
All right. Cheers. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay. And now we're going to pull in Miguel. Hopefully here in just a sec. We are running out of time, by the way, so Miguel's going to be our last caller, and we're going to have to go really quickly with this one. Pick up the phone. Miguel.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hey, man. Good. Doing great. So we're really on a time crunch here. If you have a question, can you ask it?
Yeah. I just wanted to know what you guys thought the Wii U's hardware was going to go in terms of emulation. Because for Virtual Console, I wanted to know if, you know, like there were some games on the Wii that weren't released because of emulation problems. And I wonder if Nintendo is going to continue adding Super Nintendo you know, certain games that were hard to emulate, they're going to take advantage of that on Wii U, or if it's just going to be on Wii mode.
Yeah, well, you mean like in terms of the FX chip and the,
exactly.
Like Capcom's weird MMC chips.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, the FX chip was pretty much emulated successfully, I think. At least, well, there was at least one FX game, wasn't there? Which one am I thinking of? Yoshi's Island never came out, right? But
yeah, no, it
was Star Fox?
Star Fox didn't come out, but there was one other one, I thought. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that one wasn't. But Super Mario RPG came out, and that one had a special chip in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you know, where they believe there's enough of a market and enough people who might actually buy one of those games, then, you know, I do feel it's interesting to see. Of course, we know that they're going to bring over all your Virtual Console games and they'll work on Wii U, but are they going to continue to release more Virtual Console games for those same platforms that they've previously supported?
I really hope they do.
In N64.
As someone who's trying to port a game now and has worked with a lot of the devs, it seems so simple to recreate an old game on new hardware, but it is one of the hardest things to do in development. I would say it's harder than just creating a new game from the ground up. A lot of times, yeah, your design work's done, but technically, it's really tough unless the hardware is specifically designed with some chips that were designed to emulate some of that old hardware. And you want it, I want to play some of these old games, but the market is really not large. I bet their sales numbers do not come close, except for a few key titles, to covering the development costs to do the porting.
So that they tend to focus on the easy pickings, you know, the games that work with the current emulators and don't require much extra work.
Yeah, anything that requires extra work, they're going to have to see a huge amount of sales that you just don't see when you're selling old retro titles.
Right. Well, guys, we're going to have to wrap up this segment. So thanks so much, Miguel, and thanks for calling, man. Thanks to James and John and Jeff and Brad for being on this Wii U Hype Train segment, and we hope to hear from all of you soon. Jeff, good luck with all the new versions of Rain Slick Episode 3.
Thank you very much. Here's my pitch. We've got some new DLC coming out later this year, and Rain Slick 4 looks to be really epic, coming out early next year. Maybe I can come on, even though it's not a Nintendo game. I'll come on and give you guys like an insider scoop or something sometime down the road.
Well, it's very much rooted in the foundations of Nintendo games, you know, the classic Squaresoft 16-bit RPGs. So I would not have a problem with that at all. I'm a big fan.
Appreciate that. Yeah, and thank you so much for doing the telethon. We really appreciate the community support of Child's Play. It may have started with Penny Arcade, but it's something the community has really taken a hold of and made ownership of. And we appreciate you guys carrying that standard for us and making it such a great, successful charity.
Thanks, man. Happy to
do so. Have a great day.
All right, Brad, thanks too, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Good work, guys.
Get a real quick plug in. We'll have if you're interested in more Wii U coverage on Giant Bomb, we'll have some reviews hitting this week, some quick looks, and then the current plan is to basically drag all ourselves into the office Sunday morning when the thing comes out and just live stream all day. So
holy shit!
Yeah, so we'll have all that stuff going on.
I'll be watching all that stuff. I'm a member, so I'm
a fan. Thank you, man. Appreciate your support. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here. I'm so excited.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, we're going to say goodbye to this crew and move on to the next segment. So David is on the call now, right?
Hey, how's it going? Good.
Hey, man. What's up?
Nothing much.
With that, I will be checking out.
Yeah.
All right, James, we'll check out.
But later.
Yep.
And Garnet's here, too.
Oh, my God.
Garnet is calling from his car.
No way.
Why is it calling from my car?
It's a little bit of an background noise, but it sounds all right.
It's getting better.
Yeah.
I can probably solve some of that. Let me see if I can solve that. Here, I can turn off the other computer.
So that is Garnet Lee. David Ellis, of course, from 343 Industries is here as well. And we're kicking off the decade of Metroid Prime segment here on the NWR Telethon. So this this segment, well, I'll explain a little bit more about the content here in a minute, but first I do want to introduce our guest. So first off, Guillaume Veillette, he's our editor for the Radio Free Nintendo podcast and a weekly contributor, of course. And many of you will already know his voice, but say hello, Guillaume.
Bonjour.
Guillaume's calling in from Montreal, Quebec, and he was just telling us how Metroid Prime is the game that sort of got him into, or sort of secured him into Nintendo versus Sony. So it is a very powerful game, and we'll explain why that is here in a little bit. But also wanted to introduce David Ellis from 343 Industries, currently working on Halo 4 Spartan Ops. What's up, David?
I can't be nearly as classy as Guillaume, so I'm going to give a good old-fashioned American howdy.
Howdy. Nice to have you on, man.
Nah, pleasure.
David, I don't know you too much personally. We did have breakfast together last year at E3.
I was going to say, we did soak up some alcohol with grease and carbs together last year.
Yes, we did.
I feel like once you've done that, you really know everything you need to know about another human being.
Yeah, you know, we were... We went and hung out with Louis the Cat, which is
right.
You know, rite of passage, and hung out with Billy, which was awesome. And we're going to hear from Billy a little bit later, well, a lot bit later here in the telethon. But we'll have Billy on later if we raise enough money. And awesome to have you here, David. I'm a big fan. I've been listening to you for a long time from the 1UP days, and I'm excited to have you on with your Halo perspective on Metroid Prime. That's going to be really
real quick. You just glossed over the fact that you just say Billy Berghammer doesn't podcast for less than $10,000. Is that
That's
what
right.
you said?
David's been doing it all wrong.
I know. I've been doing it for free. I'm an idiot.
God.
Yeah, we're busting our budget to get Billy in here. And finally, for this segment, we have Garnet Lee. What's up, Garnet?
Sup, yo.
I'm super excited to have you on here, man. Garnet, I don't want to make things weird, but we would not be doing this if it weren't for you. You're pretty much, as far as I'm concerned, the pod father, the creator of all gaming podcasts, and we're a big inspiration for what we do. And I mean, we've been doing now Radio Free Nintendo for 6.5 years, and that show was very much influenced by 1UP Yours right from the very beginning. And, you know, I'm still a big listener, listening to you every week on Weekend Confirmed. So I'm super thrilled to have you on here.
Sweet.
I want to pop in real quick and kind of add to that. Get the brown nose out of the way early in the segment. There are two people that I worked with, had the pleasure of working with at 1UP, that without both of which, I wouldn't be where I am today. The first is Mark McDonald, who hired me in the first place. I don't know why he hired a prison guard from North Carolina. And the second person is Garnet. Without Garnet, you know, give me the opportunity to hop on the mic with him from time to time and talk about video games. I learned a lot throughout my entire process of working at 1UP. And without both those guys, I wouldn't be where I am today. So thank you, Garnet.
Oh, thanks, Ben. Let's not overlook Cesar, because without his hangover remedies, we would not be
here. That's the truth. But I did want to do something else real quick. I had told Jonathan yesterday when we finalized that I was coming on that I had a special guest I wanted to bring with me, and I wouldn't tell anyone who it was. So at this point, Jonathan, I think this is the easiest way. Is I'm going to send you this person's contact info, and then maybe you can just add them into the conference call.
Absolutely.
One of the nice things about working at the studio is that we have a wide variety of people from all around the industry that have worked on a lot of games, and I'm very fortunate to work with someone who I know Garnet is very, very, very well. Well, he knows him pretty darn well as well. I'm going to say well a lot. It's a guy named Kynan Pearson, who's a senior designer previously at Retro, who worked on the Metroid Prime series, not necessarily Prime 1, but worked on the rest of the series. And now he's our lead multiplayer level designer at 343. So I wanted to bring him on because really he knows the series better than just about anyone. And I wanted to bring him on and give him a chance to talk a little bit about Metroid Prime as well. This is a game that was incredibly important for me because I didn't play it until I think 2003, so I didn't play it right at launch. But I was previously working in political work in Washington D.C. and left that in January of 2003, moved back to North Carolina, where I'm originally from. And there were three games that I played that year, and two in particular that I played a lot. First one's Halo because you know I bought an Xbox to play Halo, and played a bunch of that. And the other two games that I played were Legend of Zelda Wind Waker, which I absolutely adored. It's one of my favorite Zelda games of all time. But the other one was Metroid Prime. And I spent a good chunk of that year playing through that game. And it did a lot of things. It was so different from any other first-person game out at that time. It's not really a first-person shooter. And it had a huge impact on me of what I look for and enjoy in games.
That's fantastic, man. So I sent a request to Kynan. You might have to ping him and tell him to accept it before I can add him to the call.
Cool. I will just mute myself real quick and then go yell at him because we're both in the office.
Oh, okay.
Awesome.
I love that that these guys are going to be talking about Metroid Prime from the very den of Halo, from the place where Halo comes from, which is so cool because, I mean, Halo and Metroid Prime have been kind of competitors for a long time, and yet I feel like they inform each other in some interesting ways going forward. Maybe that's just my maybe that's my biased perspective, and maybe we can ask these guys whether they think there's any validity to that. Garnet, you were kind of mentioning over, I think it was over Twitter earlier this week, that you feel it's mainly just kind of superficial, maybe in just some of the maybe only as recently as Halo 4 and some of the Forerunner art design.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the things about Metroid is that there's a lot of people who talk about it, and probably more people who talk about it than have actually played it. So there's a lot of frame of reference that doesn't come into play there, because you could look at it and superficially it appears to be similar. But I would argue that if anything, Metroid Prime is less a shooter than it is a just really amazing 3D reinterpretation of the whole Metroidvania design ethos.
Yeah, that was a lot of the discussion around, well, Nintendo coined the FPA term, right? They wanted people to talk about this as a first-person adventure instead of a first-person shooter. I think that people who had played Super Metroid and previous Metroid games got it. You know, once they sat down with a controller, they understood, oh, okay, this is Metroid in 3D. But I'm not sure if everyone who picked up the game who had perhaps this was their first contact with a Metroid game, I'm not sure if they really picked up on that.
Yeah, you know, the more you play the game, though, I played the first hour and a half of it last night just as a refresher, and it is really striking how quickly, especially once you land on the planet Talon 4, and actually the little title comes up on the screen. It says Talon Overworld. And that, right. I remember back in 2002 when I first played the game, I remember that was the point where I started just kind of squealing, because the fact that they even called it an overworld implies so much in terms of exploration and hidden things and access to dungeons. And it almost puts you in this Zelda mindset, which is actually a really good place to be to understand and appreciate what the game is going to give to you. And it removes you so far from any kind of first-person shooter that was out at that time.
Yeah, and at the same time, I had never thought about that, but I guess it's another way that the game wears the fact that it's a game on its sleeve, just like the floating missile power-ups or the floating energy balls and things like that. You know, like you wouldn't call, unless I'm mistaken, I don't think it's an actual space term, an overworld.
It depends on what novelist you're reading, I guess.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Overworld. So for me personally, I'm actually really glad that Nintendo, going back to coining the term first-person adventure game, because even though first-person shooter games were still relatively new to the console experience, I mean, you had GoldenEye, Perfect Dart, and the year previously you had Halo. But outside of that, there were other games, but not a lot of them. And so I think that was important to set the context for what this game is going to be. It's not, you know, a traditional first-person shooter, and I love the way the game starts. You know, it starts with the sort of, you know, classic kind of experience going on there, and then getting kind of stranded on this world, and you're just by yourself, and the sense of just, I don't know, there's almost a sense of melancholy to the beginning of that game, which, I mean, for me personally, that takes a lot of guts to pull off, especially nowadays. There's a desire to just never leave the player with any breathing room, always allow them just, always keep throwing stuff at them. And yeah. I actually think some of the best experiences for me personally, and going back to other series as well, it are those moments in between the action when you get a chance to kind of catch your breath, sort of internalize what you just went through, and sort of prepare yourself for, you know, stepping forward and going forward.
I like that word you use, David, melancholy, because that it really does capture the tone of the whole Metroid franchise for me. And it's what sets it apart from almost any other game. There's just, especially, you know, you go back to the 80s and 90s, there was almost nothing like that. But even now, it's a fairly rare quality in a video game. And, you know, in the older games, they would usually accomplish that by putting you in this kind of underground cavern. And it's really dark and foreboding, and you have these alien creatures just kind of crawling around, and it doesn't feel like they're necessarily attacking you. It just feels like that's where they live, and you're invading their space. And it really puts you on this kind of shaky ground, and you feel like you're not all that comfortable being there, which is a pretty incredible effect to produce on 8-bit hardware or even 16-bit hardware. And the way Metroid Prime pulls it off is really just as effective, but in a totally different way, because when you land on that planet, you get out of your spaceship, and all of a sudden it's raining and it's dark and it's almost kind of foggy. And it's the total opposite of this kind of scripted Call of Duty-like experience where they're constantly just pushing you forward and throwing things at you. Instead, they put you on this planet. You have this big space, several different exits around you, different choices, and you're not really told where to go. The expectation, it's just implied, really, but it's like you get off the ship, and now you're supposed to wander around and find things. And that, in a first-person game, is so unusual and so brave. And it says a lot about the confidence in the designers of the game that they've built this world in such a way that even though, you know, you might have some false starts, you might not be sure exactly what to do first, you will eventually get around and find the things that they want you to find. So yeah, Kynan is here. I'm going to add him into the call now.
Awesome. And I think this is actually a perfect spot when we do get him on the call because Kynan and I were talking a little bit about this before we went on the air. I had to, of course, stop him because we were kind of using up some of our material before we got on. But I think
you have to save it for the show.
Yeah, you got to save it for the show. but I think the fact that – I think it actually speaks to Nintendo's confidence in Retro, but also Retro's confidence in themselves. I think the fact that Nintendo kind of let Retro – do what they felt was right for the game. Everything was in service to that game. And so all these decisions were made because it was the right call for this game and this experience they were wanting to make. I remember the kind of knee-jerk reactions when they first announced Metroid Prime and showed it off, and the fact that it was first person, people were freaking out. And, you know, as fans are want to do when you veer from their expectations of what the perfect experience of that franchise is. And so there was a lot of pressure on Retro to you know, deliver it. I would imagine there had to have been some internal pressure to sort of acquiesce to that expectations, fans' expectations. And so I all hats off to them, the fact that they stuck to their guns and absolutely just knocked it out of the park with Metroid Prime.
Yeah, and they didn't, and it's not even just that they very successfully brought this franchise into 3D. Much later than a lot of other franchises had been done. You know, this series totally skipped the N64 generation. And I often go back and think what that game might have looked like, you know, and there, somewhere in some vault in Japan, there has to be some kind of prototype of Metroid 64. And I would kill to see that. But, you know, ultimately, I feel like the things that Metroid is all about would have been a lot more difficult to convey on N64. And part of me is, although it was torturous at the time, part of me is kind of glad that we had to wait until GameCube to get that full realization.
Eight long years.
Kynan's on call now. Hey, man.
How's it going?
Good to have you here. So David was... David was hyping you up a little bit, Kynan, but could you just tell us what you do now at 343 and what you did then on Retro Studios?
Yeah, so I'm the lead multiplayer level designer over here at 343 Industries. But previously I was at Retro Studios for about 7.5 years. I was a senior designer over there. I got started just after Metroid Prime had come out, so I worked on Prime 2, 3 Trilogy, and Donkey Kong Country Returns. For like the Prime series, mostly I did level design and planning.
Awesome.
So if you're angry about how difficult Prime 2 was, you can direct your anger at Kynan. It was all his fault.
I was only angry when I had one weekend to play the game for the launch date, and it was the same weekend I was trying to study for finals back in college. That was really rough. And there were no game facts because the game wasn't out yet. So
that was a pretty rough weekend.
So just to catch you up, what we were talking about, we were sort of talking a little bit about how the game starts off and how you're sort of kind of left alone and you're just exploring, and talked a little bit about the fact that how the game was created, the fact that it was this first-person game that was exploratory in nature versus just sort of wall-to-wall action.
Yeah, I think that's one of the great things about retro is that they're given the reins to do original things. They don't care about what's happening in other games or whatever. They make the game that they're working on function for whatever it needs to be. And Metroid was always about isolation, and that was something that was really awesome because you didn't have a frame of reference talking to people that let you realize you were in a game. It was more like you were just isolated on this alien world doing your own thing, and it was just up to you to make all your own discoveries and play, and you could really get into that experience because a lot of the game conventions that had existed previously weren't being utilized in Prime. And then just in terms of talking to people or having dialogue, there was none of that. So it was literally fully about isolation, and that was actually just really cool to experience.
So that goes directly in contradiction with what I was saying earlier about how the game wears the fact that it's a game on its sleeve with the floating power-ups. But I'll accept it.
Well, no, I mean, it's a direct sequel, you know, or not sequel, but it's a spiritual successor to Super Metroid. And so a lot of the conventions that existed in Metroid, I mean, it is literally just a game, but there was nothing in it that kind of took you out of the experience, or, you know, like you wouldn't, again, talk to a character over and over and have them repeat lines of dialogue so that you're like, okay, this is fake.
Right. Yeah. It's a very organic world for sure. In a lot of ways, actually. So now that the whole crew is here, I wanted to formally introduce the segment and explain the reason that why we're talking about Metroid Prime today. I mean, I'm happy to talk about it every day, but I'm usually rebuffed when that happens. So, but this is a special occasion because it's more or less the 10-year anniversary of Metroid Prime being released back in November 2002. You know, the GameCube had already been out for a year, and we'd seen some really good stuff in the first year, but I think Metroid Prime, for a lot of people, was the awakening of that system. It was the moment where you felt like this was a very legitimate hardcore gaming platform, and there was something that people who only owned other systems really wanted to buy a GameCube to play. And this was a system seller for a lot of people. And for a lot of people, it really introduced them back to Nintendo after having been PlayStation fans for a while, or maybe have been an early adopter of Xbox so they could play Halo. And this would, I think, Metroid Prime absolutely sold GameCube to a lot of Halo fans early in those early days. And you know, there are some interesting similarities visually and in terms of theme that were maybe kind of sparse early on, but maybe a little bit later we can talk more about how those similarities changed over time and evolved as the two series propagated through several games. But the other thing, the other sort of part of the theme of doing this episode is that it's been a decade since Metroid Prime came out, and Metroid Prime also happens to be the Nintendo World Report Game of the Decade. And I wanted to give people who weren't familiar with that process, it was about 2.5 years ago we went through this process in early 2010, and we said, let's try to figure out what are the best games that were released in the 2000s, between 2000 and 2009. And we asked people to submit, I think we ended up with like 20 or 25 sort of shortlisted games, and then on the podcast on RFN, went through this horrible process. It's one of the best episodes we ever did. We spent about 2 hours culling this list down into six games, and you know, a lot of discussion went on. It was very similar to kind of the giant bomb game of the year deliberations that go on for hours and hours and hours, and it was really fun to do. And from there, we didn't try to pick one ourselves. It was just us four guys. So we then took that list out to the fans and put up a poll in our forums and asked people to vote among those six. And Metroid Prime was a pretty clear winner. And I think it was probably the favorite of most of us on the podcast as well. But we, you know, we wanted to really leave that choice up to the listeners and to the readers of the site. And just to give you an idea of the company that this game was among, the runners up in that poll were Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask, Super Smash Bros. Melee, Super Mario Galaxy, Wii Sports, and Resident Evil 4. Heavy hitters, all of them.
Pretty good company, all of those games.
Yeah.
And also extremely different. Which I appreciate.
Yeah, it was a very diverse group. We tried to make it so. But yeah, we felt that these games were – one of the big criteria that we were using in sort of down selecting to this short list was that the game had to be very influential, like in some ways very unique, but also a game that other people clearly took notice of and tried to integrate elements of because it was just such a game changer. And I think Metroid Prime, more than any of these games, fits that bill. So I wanted to kind of throw it out to the panel here, since none of you guys, including Guillaume, were involved in that deliberation. Obviously, Kynan, you might be biased, but do you guys all agree that Metroid Prime should at least be in the consideration for the game of the decade? And do you think that the impact of the game holds up 10 years later?
I think for myself personally, I mean, it's extraordinarily polished experience, really from beginning to end. I mean, there are bits here and there that you can find flaws with, as with any game. But it was just so unique at the time, and I actually think for me personally, I think one of the unfortunate things is that I think it was influential aesthetically to a lot of games, but I think from whether it's controls or the experience of exploration in first person at the expense of combat, I don't know that a lot of games have necessarily taken, not to have a pun on the morph ball, but taken that ball and run with it. I think the Metroid Prime series has continued from between 1, 2, and 3, sort of continued down this separate path that seemed to be, in a lot of ways, separate from the rest of the industry, which I appreciate as a person who enjoys like a wide breadth of games. But I don't know that there were a lot of games that sort of took gameplay aspects from it. Definitely aesthetically, I think you can definitely see influences, the obvious one being the HUD elements compared to like Republic Commando. Some people even saw similarities to the HUD for our game in Halo 4 to give the appearance that you're this person inside this helmet with the curved nature of the glass or metal or whatever of the helmet to kind of denote that stuff. But I think gameplay-wise, I don't know that a lot of games have taken necessarily from it.
Well, yeah, off of that list, I would say that Resident Evil 4 had the biggest impact in terms of being copied in terms of its gameplay. But do we think that Metroid Prime, like, why is it that it hasn't really been copied all that much? Is it because the sales were perhaps not as impressive to other publishers? Is it because it was on a Nintendo console? And
my guess is because it's really hard to make a game like Metroid Prime.
Mm. Well, I think that there's more to it than that. I think that really, so you ask about two questions there. Should it be considered in your games of the decade sort of historic perspective? Absolutely. What's the impact? Well, the unfortunate part is the impact has been marginalized. It's really only been influential to itself. And that's because you're asking, like, why did it go that way? You know, I think that what's happened, and you see this is also, you know, Bond games came up briefly. And this is one of the reasons that I think that Bond games have even struggled, is that the design focus to first-person shooters, which everything that has a first-person point of view is now lumped into, has become, from a design standpoint, I have to give the player something new, and something new equates to a new environment. And the whole beauty of Metroid is that it embraced the, as we started off saying, the overworld. It embraced this idea of, I'm in this world, and people knocked it for quote-unquote backtracking. So that shows you how much people had already started moving their mindsets that way. There's something elegant about going into an environment, experiencing the environment, and then coming back to it later and having the newness of it not be that, oh, I just gave you a new set of textures on the wall, but I gave you a new set of objectives and accomplishments and things to do within that space that you already grew intimate with. Like, yes, there's the aha of, oh, I just walked into this room. I've never been here before. Whoa, this looks cool. And then there's, okay, I know my way around this space station. What's going on here? What can I do?
Yeah, and yeah. I think to add on what Garnet said there, I think part of it was the fact that when they did give you those new rooms, you felt like you knew this world intimately, and it would turn its on its head, and you'd suddenly, in some cases, be lost again. And I actually liked that because it once again, sort of in the classic kind of Metroid perspective, pulled the rug out from underneath you. Just when you think you have learned everything, you have all the power, something will come along and sort of knock you back down and be like, no, you're not quite ready yet. This is a process. This is a journey you're going on.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, to Garnet's point, I think it's absolutely probably my single favorite thing about the whole Metroid franchise, and I love that Prime crystallized it so well and did new things with it. But it's the idea that you're entering these very dense environments that you don't fully comprehend the first time you see them. And as you play more of the game and you spend more time in these places, you understand more about how they connect to each other and how the different features built into the game work. And it also speaks to the whole kind of Indiana Jones archaeologist aspect of the Metroid franchise, which is that you're entering a place that already exists. And the goal is not to change that place. The goal is the idea is that you go to these places and, you know, every time you go back to them, even the enemies are back in the same place that they were before, which might seem a little artificial, but I actually really like that because I think it serves the same purpose as the architecture of the level designs as well, in that every time you go back here, that room is set up the same way every time you go back to it. The difference is you. The thing that has changed over time, every time you go back to it, what's changed is you. And so now you change the way you approach it because you have new abilities and you have new understanding of the way the game works. And I think there aren't enough games that pull that off. But I really cherish Metroid for having the guts to do something like that. I feel like, again, I'll say it again, maybe this is not true, but my opinion is the reason that we don't have more games like this is because they're just really complicated and really difficult to pull off.
Well, and the designers just aren't thinking in that modality because it's all about this linear progression, telling the next space, telling the next story. No knock against the guys here who've done Halo 4, but Halo 4, same thing, because it's always about that next step of the journey, the next step of the saga that the protagonist is on. And sometimes, depending on what sort of tale you're weaving, there are opportunities to come back to spaces. And I think that, you know, the only ones who have even tried to dip their toes in it were a couple of the Tomb Raider games where you came back through spaces. It's really difficult because in there, you're talking about a puzzle, and once you solve the puzzle, well, how do I make all the gears and everything turn and do anything interesting again? And so take it to its ultimate extension. Can you imagine a Call of Duty where you ever once went back into an environment that you had been in before? People would be, they would be in uproar over them. Everyone would be beside themselves. I can't believe they reused these assets. I can't believe they brought me back to a place. This is so lazy. Without it's, ever it, thinking.
It's funny you mentioned that, Garnet, I don't want to go too far into like Halo territory because we're here to talk about Metroid. But with Spartan Ops is one of the things that we actually kind of, and people have noticed, is that we actually bring players back to portions that they may have experienced in the campaign. And we may do it in some cases repeated times. And every time we're trying to layer on a little bit of the story, trying to actually show you something that you didn't see before, give you access to things you didn't have access for, trying to make these spaces, even if we bring you back a couple of times, always give you something new within that space to expand your kind of perception of that space and make it feel different and new every time you pop into it.
Metroid. What better carrot is there than coming into a really cool environment and space and seeing something that I just can't quite get to or deal with right now, but I know is going to be awesome when I can.
Yeah. That's the magic moment.
Sorry. One thing that I wanted to mention, just kind of getting back to the games being influenced by it, the visor system in Metroid in terms of allowing you to see things in a different way, I do think has influenced other games.
That's fair. Batman.
Even leading into Batman or into Resident Evil 4, when you get to the portion where you use the heat vision to see the weak spots in the enemies, but also just game format-wise, unlocking abilities to allow you to progress to different areas, I actually think that some of that influenced things like BioShock. And there are games that have taken some of the foundational elements of the Metroid Prime series and used them in different ways, but just maybe not in an identical fashion. Ultimately, because I think with Metroid, everything matters. Like, every single layout Every single design element, every ability, every pickup, everything in that game was crafted and planned in such a way that if any of it didn't come together, that the game just wouldn't work. And that's a big
risk,
a big task to take if you're making a new game and you don't know how to do it already.
Right. Mm.
I can think of another series, although it's way more linear, but Prince of Persia. I recently played Forgotten Sands for the Wii, and there's a lot of instances where you'll be revisiting areas and like, oh, okay, so now, you know, earlier I was down there, now I'm up here, and you get a new perspective. Or also, you could also be just going through the exact same path, but with your new abilities, you can reach new exits. So, but no, I don't think I can think of a series that has taken non-linearity to the extent that Metroid Prime did.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the only series I feel like that really compares to it is The Legend of Zelda. And we've talked a lot on the podcast before about how Metroid and Zelda are really kind of parallel franchises, and I think they feed off of each other in some really interesting ways. But I think Metroid Prime really took it to the next level, and I think integrated aspects of Zelda into the Metroid series in a way that hadn't been done before. If you look at even just sort of entering these different regions that you go to, like the Chozo Ruins, is almost like a dungeon in itself. And you go in there and you get one or two power-ups that are in there that help you kind of unlock the dungeon. And then you get to the boss and you really have to use the power-ups that you've gotten on that boss in order to solve the boss. And this was something that I had been sort of in Zelda before. I mean, it's sort of in Metroid before, but I think they really ramped it up and intensified it. And since we've got Kynan here, I wanted to ask you, I've done a few interviews with Retro and with Nintendo about Metroid Prime over the years. And one of the really interesting things I learned is that the producer from Nintendo on the Metroid Prime series was Kensuke Tanabe, who was the director of Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past. And I wonder if you got the sense that his input into Metroid Prime was really kind of pushing it to adopt some of these elements of Zelda in a way that the franchise hadn't done before.
I don't necessarily think it's that he was pushing those elements. I think in a lot of ways we respected Tanabe-san's experience and knew that he had that experience. And so for instance, like the Dark World, Light World aspects in Metroid Prime 2, We just drew on his experience, and it was stuff that we wanted to do and that we had presented to them, but definitely just like having the collective knowledge of Nintendo at our disposal with all of the experience that everyone in SPD had had and whatnot was invaluable to the process. But Retro was coming up with the ideas, and we were presenting to him that we wanted to do this, and then having his experience kind of guide us through that process was awesome.
All right. That's awesome. So, sorry, I'm multitasking here. The hour is coming up here pretty soon, so we do want to get some callers in. I know Garnet was excited to do that, and we're trying to have people call in throughout the day for various segments. If you want to talk to these guys, if you have questions about Metroid Prime or just comments and things you want to get out of your system, send a Skype request to carl.castaneda. You can look in the chat room for the spelling on that. It's Carl with a K. And Carl will filter through those requests and get some people lined up, and we'll help patch them in here in a few minutes. So before we get to that, if I can pull my notes back up, I wanted to ask you guys about how this system kind of fits in with the milieu of Nintendo. I look at Metroid Prime specifically as a game that was really kind of shocking to come out of Nintendo. I mean, it was in an era where there were a few games like that. There was Pikmin and Eternal Darkness also that really felt outside of what you would expect Nintendo to do, and it was a very, very exciting time. And Metroid Prime is the one game from that era that I think has really endured, not least because of the sequels. But even today, you go back and play it, and it feels like you can feel Nintendo's polish all over it, but it also feels like something that Nintendo themselves, without the help of a Western studio, might not ever be able to pull off, or might not ever even think about pulling off. And I wanted to ask you guys if you think Metroid Prime has influenced other Nintendo games since then, or if you feel like it really does kind of exist in this weird kind of pocket of being sort of a quasi-Nintendo game.
Wow, that is a hard question. Other than the only names that pop to mind are like Metroid Prime Hunters or things like that, like that other Western studios have been working on, or but yeah, you can't really think, or Nintendo Land, there will be a superficial kind of similarity there in terms of gameplay. Mm-hmm. But no, it doesn't sound like Mario is going to get a visor anytime soon.
Well, I mean, I think the obvious comparison is, most recently was Metroid Other M, which, whatever you think about that game is in a lot of ways very, very different from Metroid Prime. They kept some things aesthetically similar, but it's very different. So I would speak, for just speaking personally from my perspective, I think that speaks a lot to Retro more than Nintendo. I mean, Nintendo obviously gave Retro tons of support and freedom, creative freedom to do what they wanted to do and do what they felt was best for the game. But I don't know that outside of Retro, another studio would have been able to make that game within Nintendo. And I don't know that Nintendo would have made that game without Retro. I agree with that point that was brought up earlier. And so I think in a lot of ways we got the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, Metroid Prime exists basically.
We're getting a little bit
lacking.
I don't know if the rest of you guys can hear.
Oh, sorry. It's its own thing, and it exists and couldn't really exist in any other way than with the relationship between Retro and Nintendo. And I mean, that's pretty much why you don't see anything else like it. It's its own thing, and it's kind of it happened because of the people involved and the time and the system and all of those things. And if any of those things had changed, it wouldn't be what it is.
Yeah, I think back to when Metroid Prime came out, it had been about 8 years since Super Metroid had come out. And really, I think it was probably the first sci-fi game to come from Nintendo at all since Star Fox 64, and that was 5 years earlier, back in 97. So this is part of why it was such a breath of fresh air to have this game come out on GameCube and to see just how sci-fi it was. I mean, much more than Star Fox was. And it made me excited because that's a style and it's a kind of game that I really like, and is something that just hadn't really been served up very much on Nintendo consoles up to that point. It's been really great to see that the game performed really well and that people wanted more of that. And so I think it has helped Nintendo to see that there's a market for this kind of game that's a little more serious. It's still very colorful, but in a different way than a lot of Nintendo's games are visually. And it's a very complex game. I think that's one thing that people take for granted if you've been playing Metroid or Zelda for a long time. You've played a lot of games over the series. sorry, there's some funny stuff on in the chat right now. But it's something you take for granted is that these games are really complicated and they're difficult to play. They really ask a lot of the player. They ask you to learn to read three-dimensional maps. They ask you to put things together spatially. They ask you to solve puzzles using...
They ask you to fight good boss fights.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is chat, actually, someone just brought up Jet Force Gemini, and anyone who got to the end of Jet Force Gemini knows what a boss fight is all about, because that is, insane. No one does anymore. No one talk about not having the drive from the audience to do something in design. Can you imagine someone putting an end boss in a game as hardcore as the end of Jet Force Gemini?
People no, that's like, as far as what? I ever got in that game. I couldn't beat him.
It's great stuff. It's great stuff, but then that whole challenge level is from a whole other era. It's like so evocative of memories that we had, right?
Right.
Well, and not just the fact that it's a boss battle, but the fact that they were good. Doing good boss battles in a first person really from a first person perspective is very, very difficult.
Well, Dave, you very well know my opinion of boss battles, especially in first person games.
Oh yeah, I mean most of them are garbage. Most of them are garbage, and mostly you'd rather do without them. But yeah, I think a part of it, I think you can't say enough about the lock-on mechanic in Metroid Prime. It's actually a shame that more games haven't actually taken that and run with it, because I don't think every first-person game has to be all about twitch shooting or being very accurate and everything like that. I think just that mechanic alone removed the barrier to entry for first-person shooting mechanics in Metroid for a lot of players. And, you know, Metroid's not about twitch thing. It's not about being super accurate. It's about, you know, finding patterns in the enemies you're fighting, using the right weapons against them, timing them correctly, and being able to lock onto the enemy allowed you the sort of freedom in third person or in first person to be able to move in three dimensions without having to juggle all this extra stuff in the background of, oh, I got to aim at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, and our friend Michael in the chat is mentioning that we really should bring up Portal and Portal 2 here. I think that's I'm glad he said something. I've talked about it before, but it wasn't coming to mind. But I think Portal is a series that has been very heavily influenced by Metroid Prime in terms of platforming and first person, in terms of puzzle solving, especially these spatial puzzles where it's all about how do I get from here to here. And in Metroid, those things are sometimes solved by just having the correct item or from approaching something in a certain way. And Portal is much more that's what it's about. You know, they take the combat out and it lets them focus much more on that. But I think Portal is a game that you wouldn't have without Metroid Prime. It's so thoroughly informed by the kind of game design, especially the mechanics of the moving around, the jumping, the aiming, is a very core to what Portal is, and I think it's pretty obvious when you play that game.
That's actually a really good call out. I'm glad Michael brought that up. I would have been kicking myself after the segment if I'd forgot to mention those games. I think in a lot of ways, yeah, Portal 1 especially, it opens up, you're just by yourself, and in the case of Portal, you have one character that you're interacting with, and it's one way. So basically this person's acting as the narrator. Yeah, Portal definitely. I don't know whether it is an overt kind of homage to kind of that sort of design sensibilities of Metroid, but there's no doubt in my mind that it definitely influenced folks who worked on those games.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know, if it influenced them, but I think that foundationally they used similar design philosophies at Valve and for the Portal series, and that everything is measured and you're actually playing the game from the perspective of the camera. So a lot of attention to detail goes into crafting all of the rooms and all of the layouts and all of the elements so that you're looking at them even though you don't realize you are. So everything is kind of driving your attention to the details that are important. And everything is also, you know, just basically situated and framed in such a way where it is able to express more information and require more of the player. So it's just a cleanliness and a craft that I think you don't find in a lot of games where everything is intentional. There's nothing in there just because.
Right. All right, guys. Well, we're getting close to the end of the hour. We're going to try to fit in a couple of calls here. I think we have Darkerai online.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yeah, sorry. My internet's been giving me trouble.
That's okay. You've had some lag, too. It's going to come in and out during the day. So, Darkerai, what was your question for the group?
Well, my thought is, you know, we have a game like Halo, I know is relevant to a certain person here. You know, it's look back, remember, like a lot of people see that as like a huge historical game back in the day. And I get the feeling that, Metroid Prime is really only looked back in that way by Nintendo fans. Like, you know, I have a lot of friends that are more primarily PlayStation, more primarily Xbox, and they don't really see Metroid Prime as significant as, you know, I think it is. For whatever reason, you know, maybe it was never that important to them or whatever. But I'm kind of wondering if you guys ever think that Metroid Prime is going to really ever be, you know, as historically remembered as Halo is, or if it's just going to be something that Nintendo fans remember.
Good question.
I remember that there was a conversation at IGN, I believe, back when Matt Casamassina and Craig were still around, and they basically, like, half the staff at IGN wanted Metroid Prime, you know, somewhere near the top of the top 100 games list, and half the staff didn't think that it should be on there at all. So there was this huge disconnect between, you know, like, several people, who really, really didn't care, and some, you know, like the Nintendo fans who really, really believed in it.
I can't imagine there are a lot of people that – I think it's the people who don't necessarily give Metroid Prime the credit that it deserves for what it did extraordinarily well. If you played the game, you have to recognize great design and great planning, as Kynan said, of planning out this world and this experience and the way it works. You just have to give credit to that. There are just very few studios who are capable of pulling off something like that at the quality bar and polish bar that they did, especially as a first title on a new platform. Because in when development, anytime you're moving to a new platform, there's a tax. We use the term, you know, platform tax is something that's thrown around. It's like anytime you're working on a new platform, there's things that come associated with that. I would imagine working with the non-standard disk format brought some troubles as well with Retro, working with the GameCube. And fitting all the content in there. So I think for people who played it, it's absolutely going to stay relevant and it's going to stay influential for a long time. And I think it's important for people who played it, not just Nintendo fans. I mean, I think that term gets thrown around a little loose. I mean, I'm just a fan of games that enjoys playing Nintendo products. Yeah. I also enjoy playing my Xbox. I enjoy playing Sony PlayStation from time to time. Just a gamer, you know, I like playing games. So, and Metroid Prime, I want more games like that. And you know, I don't know that we're going to see many anytime soon. But, you know, I hope for the best.
Yeah, hopefully something on Wii U. Well, I guess we'll see what Retro's doing. But, I do feel like whatever they do, there will be elements of Metroid Prime in it. Even with Donkey Kong, you know, you could see in the density of the environments and the way the graphics worked, I think you could see some elements of that. But just my feeling on your question, Darkrai, about why maybe Metroid Prime isn't as appreciated in the wider conversation in the gaming industry is probably just because less people played it than a game like Halo. And I think part of that is because the platform it was on was less popular, or it was less saturated among GameCube owners than Halo was among Xbox owners. I mean, remember, everybody who had an Xbox had Halo. Everybody.
Well, and also, Halo is a pretty disparate audience. It's like you have a room full of 10 Halo fans, and you ask them what part of the series they love the best, and you're going to get 10 different answers. There are people who swear by campaign. That's all they play is campaign. They like exploring every nook and cranny, finding every secret, finding ways to trick through different portions of the level and different sequences. There are people who are just multiplayer that don't play the campaign at all. They're all about that. Initially with the first Halo, was that four-player, split-screen, LAN Halo experience, you know, Blood Gulch, Warthogs, CTF, go nuts. But then you also have
Final Destination, no items.
And then you also have people who it's just about the story. And like they appreciate the story. There are Halo fans that literally just read the books that never even play the games. Wow. And so I think for Metroid, they obviously had the story there, but there was no other avenue outside of the game to get that stuff and to really expand on it. I actually think I love how Retro told that story, Metroid Prime. It was very subtle in a lot of ways. You basically had as much story as you wanted out of it. If you went through and scanned everything and read everything, you got so much more richer appreciation for the world that you were, you know, making your way through. Right. But unless you did that, you didn't really get an appreciation for it. So I think not to reduce it to, and I don't mean this at all, but not to reduce it to a lack of multiplayer, but there's an audience out there that kind of only plays that. And unless it's there, maybe they won't necessarily play it. The hope is that, you know, from my perspective, one of the reasons Spartan Ops exists in Halo 4 is that to try to bridge the gap between those multiplayer fans and campaign fans to give both an experience that they can appreciate and maybe get some of those campaign people to play multiplayer and maybe some of those multiplayer people to play campaign. But I think, you know, mostly with Metroid, I think the people who don't hold it up in as high esteem as they should, they just never played it. So I don't think I don't think you can play that game and not be impressed by what Retro pulled off.
Yeah, and again, I think Metro is a little bit harder to get into. It's a very dense, complicated experience that calls upon skills that you may not have used before in other games. And so even people who played it might not have gotten far enough to fully appreciate what it was doing. But We're going to have to move on. We're running out of time really quickly here. We had one question from Darren, and Darren was having some technical problems and couldn't get in on a call. By the way, thanks, Darkerai. Really appreciate you calling in. But Darren sent in his question over text, so I'm going to read it out really quickly here. He said he has a question for Kynan and would like to ask what was his most challenging and rewarding moment at Retro Studios on the Prime Trilogy?
I guess challenging and rewarding moments are the fact that, you know, we had created something that stood on its own merit. Like, there's nothing that really compares to it. The game works, and there's so many unique elements in Metroid Prime that you just don't find anywhere else. And so it is an experience that stands alone. And that's just the team that put it together and kind of the relationship that we all had. Like, it's just an achievement that game was able to exist. And a lot of credit goes to Nintendo for, you know, allowing that to happen, because we didn't do things like focus testing or whatever to figure out, you know, trying to generalize what to do in certain areas if whatever people aren't enjoying it. We just trusted our instincts and worked together and made this experience that, you know, was its own thing. So that's definitely what I feel like I'm most proud of, and a lot of the team were as well.
Awesome. Well, guys, thank you all so much. It's been really fun talking about this stuff with you guys, and I just really appreciate you guys coming on and supporting the telethon.
Now, thank you very much, and happy to participate, and good luck with the rest of the telethon.
Yeah, all right, thanks so much.
Absolutely fantastic. Thanks, Jonathan.
Yeah, man. Hey, the promo on We Can Confirm was really fantastic, by the way.
I'm just glad to have been on with podcasting legends and Garnet Lee and David Ellis.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
I would be glad to have a USB mic if we do this again.
All right. That sounds good. Yeah, Garnet, we've tried to get you on RFN before, but the problem is that we record at the same time you record We Can Confirm. So we'll work something out eventually, I hope.
We should all change plans. We should change to the exact same time again on different times.
Hey, Kynan, thanks so much, man. It was nice to meet you, sort of.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on, and it was great meeting you as well.
All right, guys. We will some other time, but for right now, we're going to have to set up for the Eurocast.
So, hi, guys. This is the Eurocast that came from across sea. I am your host, Dan Koopman. Joining me in the call are Carly Young.
Hi, I'm Carly.
Hi, I'm Carly. Hi, I'm Daisy. How you doing?
I'm not bad, thanks. And you?
I'm pretty good. And next to that, we have, for his podcasting debut, our light in the darkness, Thomas Molina.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, but quite nervous.
Is it that Tom was listening this time last year? Now he's on the show.
Yep.
Incredible.
Quite an interesting switch in perspective. Call it technically my third telephone, having called in back when I didn't have a name. I was just Kilimanjaro, terrible username. Now I can use my real name.
Well, that's just great. We are here to talk about the European side of things, and we're going to do that in a few segments. First, we're going to talk about, well, Nintendo of Europe a bit in general. We're going to talk about our operations. We're going to talk about how it's all set up, basically, and distribution and what have you. We're not going to make it too long because we don't want to make it too boring, but we're going to bring some interesting points, I hope. This is the first time for me ever doing something like this. To kind of start, and to start with an interesting fact, did you guys know that Nintendo of Europe started from a court case with Atari in North America?
This is news to me.
Yeah, I don't think I remember reading that.
So, what happened was that there was a lawsuit by Atari that could bring the entire company down in the United States. And there were stakes at hand, basically. And Europe had already established like a presence in Europe so far and had distribution partners like Mattel. But Nintendo felt they should have a European subsidiary. So, but the European market was quite of challenging. So at the beginning, they brought one of the prominent members of Nintendo of America, which was Ron Judy, to Paris. And he made that happen, basically. And from that came Nintendo of Europe. And after that, Hiroshi Yamaguchi wanted to have in more countries. And that's how, for example, Nintendo of Australia came to be. So it all came down back to a court case, which Nintendo, in the end, actually won.
Well, I'm learning things already.
That's quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, but let's talk about their operation. So they are based in Rosenheim and in Frankfurt in Germany. Their main office is in Germany. So if like a European press member has to preview a game or has to do certain things with Nintendo, have conversations with them, it's usually in Frankfurt. If it's a big press, if it's smaller press, it's usually brought under by like various different subsidiaries. For example, in my country, we have Benelux, who does it for Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg. We have the one for Portugal and Spain, and of course the UK, which was established, I think, in 2000. So it's almost like 12 years ago that they had like a dedicated one in the UK. And it's the same year that also Benelux came together. So it all evens out here for the group of people we have here. So for 12 years, they actually have been dedicated. And in the beginning, it was certainly like in the early days, we used to get games like extremely late to the party. Like, I don't know if you, like, especially at the beginning of the Wii period, we got, like, Super Paper Mario, like, what is it, like, 9 months later?
Yeah, I think that's been one of the most, like, radical changes over the course of this generation. I remember at a time, certainly when I was younger, because I've been playing Nintendo games for quite a while, and you think about, like, Europe was always renowned for getting it so much later than America, who got it so much later than Japan. But that's when it seems to have turned around. Now it seems that we get quite a lot, because we'll probably get to this in a little while, but Nintendo of Europe, they stick a lot closer to how NCL in Japan, like their operations, whereas Nintendo of America, sort of their own thing. And now they're a bit more experimental. And occasionally we get games that America doesn't at all. It's been an interesting shift.
Well,
we used to get games much later, and they ran much more slowly too.
Yep.
Yeah, we used to get like 50 Hertz games, which are, if you now go back to their Virtual Console versions, they are the utter worst. Like, they don't run as smooth as like games that are on the Virtual Console in Japan or North America.
It's slower, isn't it?
Yeah, and if you have an HDTV, it's more of a pain because they won't run half of the time.
Yeah, and there's been a couple of cases of that in the Wii generation. I think what were the two games? 2009. It was Mad World and Little King Story, which I think was a little bit of an uproar for a while that we got them. I guess Little King Story we got first, but the fact that it ran at 50 hertz. And you just, like, the frame rate was cut, and I have no idea why. I really don't understand that.
Well, I can actually think of a more recent example. We got through Nintendo of Europe, and it was published by Nintendo of Europe, and of course made by Tecmo Koei, Samurai Warriors 3. And basically, Samurai Warriors 3, the whole game won in 50 hertz. Well, North America and Japan got actually a 60 hertz version. I mean, we got it months earlier than North America, but that was still kind of shitty. And kind of shady as well. But going back to your previous point, like DS-only games we only got in Europe, a good example of that is, for example, like Face Training, which was like this very obscure retail game in Japan that actually came with a camera which you had to put in the GBA slot. And then you would test your various facial features. Which was,
I think it was an exercising game.
An exercising game for your face.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. there's a lot of jokes to make about that one.
It was targeted towards women mainly, I think.
Yeah.
Anti-wrinkle treatment, that sort of thing.
I think that's a lot of the thing.
And then the camera would act like would turn your DS into a mirror, and then you'd see yourself and you'd see the picture of the face on the other screen showing you what you should do.
We should point out that in Europe it came out as a DSi game, so it had the white cartridge, like the more wider box, which was one of the rare cases we actually got a DSi only game, because in Europe they have been pretty much non-existent.
Yeah, they didn't release the camera cartridge then.
Not really, no.
It was only the DSi.
Yeah.
It's just a really strange release, that. It seems like the nature of a lot of the Nintendo products that come out nowadays, they must have a vision that it must have some universal appeal. Like, if this is popular in Japan, then there must be some transferability to other markets. But that's one of the most peculiar cases, I think, especially given the fact that it was localized for Europe, I think, many, many years later. And
only from a completely development change, because again they had the camera as a separate thing, and that's actually where the DSi came from, because they started testing it with the camera from that face training game before the DSi was actually a thing, and then it went completely 180 and became a European game, basically from the idea that the DSi started with. So that was a certain interesting fact about that. So later on in Japan, they got all those lessons at separate releases on DSiWare. So there's also that. Another interesting thing that was certainly Japan only, but became all of a sudden this big thing in Europe, is Gem of the Band.
Another one that came a long time after Japan.
And Europe and America, I think, never reckoned with the fact that it would ever come here.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of stuff involved with that one. And you can basically make your own songs, you can sing to songs, you can play on various instruments. And that was a lot of fun. Though, you had this online store feature which you could download extra songs with, and that was not very complex in Europe. And the funny part is that I checked it recently, since for the Japanese version at least, because there's a new 3DS game coming. And the funny part is that in the Japanese version, there are still songs uploaded every single day.
Yeah, it's very popular over there. And I think in this generation in particular, I think Europe, although it might be on quite a time delay, they're kind of like the experimental group, where Japan, if they'll have a successful game over there, and years later they'll try and bring it back in, put it in Europe first to test it, to see if it can be popular in the West. And now that doesn't always work out. I think Jam of the Band is a case where commercially it didn't do too well, and I think site was known quite well for getting a bunch of copies at a very cheap price.
I think they printed a limited amount of them. I think in certain European countries you could only find them at certain stores. So I don't think they lost that much money on it. But it was certainly a case from it didn't print them that much money. It was just a peculiar case of testing their waters. And I think if it was been a success, perhaps we would have seen it in, in North America. Which brings up to another interesting game that became big here and then went to America, which is Art Academy. Art Academy started as a DSiWare-only game, which was made by Headstrong Studios, and then later they decided to do it for retail release. They started testing the waters here in Europe first, and then after that they released it in Japan and then later in North America. And that's actually went with the same case as New Art Academy. We got it a few months before Japan or America got it, which just shows how popular that franchise has become for Europe. And actual art classes have started because of Art Academy. which is quite insane for such quite a complex region.
Yeah, and even cases like it can even work in reverse sometimes. You think of a really popular franchise like Professor Layton, like you think how massive that's gotten now. And that, after it came out in Japan, went to America first, and I think was reasonably successful, but not so much. And then a few months later, it comes out in Europe, and because of like the way they were able to market it, it was really quite a lot more successful there. And then they launched a new marketing campaign in America, and it took off. And now the series is where it is today. Like an annual franchise comes out every year and does very well for them. That's another case where it seems like Europe, again, a testing ground in a way.
That's true. Maybe we wouldn't have got the sequels if it hadn't done so well.
And then
they were definitely going to be released in Japan.
Oh, definitely.
Didn't know they were going to be localized here.
Yeah.
But The funny part about that is, and it ties in directly with Professor Layton, is how Nintendo of Europe in the last few years has expanded their base in terms of translation department. Because a couple of years ago, it would be like a game would be translated in North America, then it would come to Europe with the base of the American translation in mind. And then they were translated based off that. And now it has become bigger and more compacter to the point where they actually get a game in Japanese and started translating it directly. I don't know how it will turn out with like games like in the future with Paper Mario. And I think they still use like the Treehouse localization. But for most cases right now, it's like they are more interested in doing it themselves than asking help from North America. And it was quite funny to see, for example, the Xenoblade case, where they actually took the European existing translation.
Yeah, I think it's one of the weird quirks of Nintendo of Europe is they are probably, whereas Nintendo of Europe, like some people listening might disagree with this, but they, Nintendo of America, I mean, they do sort of they sort of operate under their own assumptions. Like they'll be more willing to like go away from the Japanese operation model. Whereas I feel like Nintendo of Europe, they stick a lot closer to it. And one of the side effects of that is translations. I feel like they stick a lot closer. Whereas you see with like Nintendo of America, they will sometimes like with the localization, they'll go quite radical with it, like be willing to change quite a lot. You consider like maybe the Mario RPG games and Professor Layton as well, as we mentioned before. Like they'll be willing to do a bit more.
A good example of that, and a quite controversial one, is with Vivian of Paper Mario and the Thousand Year Door. In the original Japanese version, she was looking like a woman, but was actually a man. And in North America, they removed all references to that part. But some versions in the European version, this reference stayed in touch and completely intact. Which was one of the more weirder things that Nintendo of Europe has done. But and there's also more negative...
Only in the games. It's not only in the games, though. It's the advertising campaigns, the translations of... For example, it was when they did the 3DS price drop and the Ambassadors Club. The European posting was basically a direct translation of the Japanese, whereas they completely rewrote it for the message that was on the Nintendo.com site. And that happened a lot.
I think you can see
from the Wii U ads as well, they're completely different in Europe and in the US.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a side effect of Nintendo of Europe. They still have a Japanese president, and I'm wondering if that's maybe something to do with it. I'm not really sure about the logistics of it, but that may play a part.
I certainly think that Nintendo of Europe has become closer with Japan and are working more actively together in more cooperation as far as localizing of titles is concerned. And speaking of titles, that's the most funny part. We get more like director versions of the title. Like a recent example is that America is getting, of course, Brain Age Concentration, While it's not officially confirmed for Europe yet, we know the European title, which is Devilish Brain Training, Can You Stay Focused?
Yeah, it's like a literal translation. Like, they didn't even try to localize it. Like, literally, that is literally what it means from the Japanese. We won't change a word.
It's also because the boxes are bigger in Europe to accommodate the multi-language manual, so they can fit more lines of text into the spine so they can have a longer title.
Yeah, that's definitely the
case. The game boxes are slightly smaller in America.
Well, we just have the small Peggy logos, except if you live in Germany. Then it's actually more annoying because you have the ginormous USK logo at the left of your game box, which, personally, not a fan of that. I know that you... half of the time you live in Germany, Carly, yes. do you actually think that's annoying? Do you, the USK logo in comparison to the Peggy logo?
It doesn't take up that much more space. I think there's a couple extra lines there due to the, because it has something specific for each country. But I normally actually buy my games from the UK because you don't get multi-language carts that often anymore because they can't fit the data on anymore, I think. So bigger games, especially the ones with voice acting and movies, which they're doing the localizations of as well, they'll re-record all the voice acting, then they can't fit it all on one cart.
Yeah.
They have a separate version for each country they're doing the localization for.
So that's interesting. So the games that only have like one language track on it, will they... Because I know that normally one of the reasons that we have to wait so long for games to be released is they have to wait for it to be translated into all five of like the main European languages.
Well, but actually, you have to change
can
those
they come
rules
out
as well.
At different times?
They have actually changed those rules. They actually have changed those rules very recently, where they have announced that they want to localize as much games possible in 8 different languages, which now also includes my language, Dutch and Russian. And also Portuguese. So instead of the 5 they used to, they want to almost do every big European language on the sun, which I consider a big positive and possibly will help in the future to expand our game audience, which they, of course, struggling right now because of course, of the rise sometimes of like smartphones of other devices. But having like dedicated software with also a dedicated language for yourself can really sometimes make that difference because parents will feel more compelled to give the children something they can understand.
True. And going back to what Tom said earlier about the games being released at different times in different European countries, it did happen for Inazuma 11, and in that case it was released in Europe first, and they delayed the UK version. In fact, they had to recall the games because they wanted to release it alongside the TV series. So if we're going to have 8 different versions now for 8 countries, then we might see more of that. The games are going to be coming out all over the place.
Yeah.
That's the big difference. They have to line up with all these different countries to get it work. And sometimes this can put like a lot of pressure on Nintendo of Europe to get it overall published. I think sometimes feel that they're still struggling with that, finding the perfect spot to release their games. But sometimes
the distribution is handled by a different company in each of the countries as well, and that has to be kept in line if they want to release the game in the same day in all of these countries. Yeah.
And there's one thing that I will give a Nintendo of Europe credit for. Like they have, I feel like they have become more willing to take risks recently, and I've been pretty grateful for that. We've gotten a few games that I thought never in a million years would this be localized from Japan. Like the Operation Rainfall trio is an interesting one. I wouldn't want to talk about that too much because you've probably heard enough about that over the last year, but. I mean, you could argue, like, commercially,
I can't, not a very sensible move. Yeah. I can't say about it too much because this is pretty much NDA'd. But Nintendo of Europe was actually joking about the fact in the beginning that Nintendo of America wasn't publishing the games after they made that big statement of theirs. Remember that statement on their Facebook page where they might consider bringing those games over, but they weren't sure?
Yeah, that got a lot of people
riled up. Plans? That's the sort of general word they use. They say they have no plans to do something, then a few months later, it suddenly appears.
Yeah, like general PR speak that's just completely ambiguous and like riles people up because No, people assume that to mean the answer is no, when in fact they, for whatever reason, they can't say anything.
I think also a big difference between like Europe and North America is that we also get third-party games published by Nintendo of Europe. And in particular, in the beginning, this was mostly like Atlas games of like the Trauma Center series. And now more recently, it has become with like games from Sega and Capcom, which I can certainly say is a very positive thing.
Yeah, but, well, break so up for a second. It's, in theory,
sorry, Tom. I think...
Sorry,
I have to interrupt you for quite a second there, because we just hit the $2,500 mark, which means that the Famicast with the H4 Play guys is going to be on. It's going to go live later today, and we are pumped to hear it. Sorry, let's continue where we were, but that I find really exciting, and thank you so much for donating, everyone.
Yep.
63% of our fundraising goal.
Absolutely. So,
where were we? I was just saying, in theory, I think it's great that they would be willing to help some of these third-party developers like push their games. But I feel like some of the examples we've seen recently, you think like, is it Heroes of Ruin? I think Nintendo was meant to be helping out there. And I'm struggling to think of what they actually did to help out there. I don't think Heroes of Ruin was particularly successful when it came out in Europe, despite the apparent backing from Nintendo. So, in theory, you know, a good progressive move, but I don't know if the dividends have really paid off. I think if they did, it was very minimal. Like I never saw very much about it.
Well, they put out their own press releases and their own videos specifically made by Nintendo for Heroes of Ruin here. But the big problem is that they... I don't feel they did much promotion directly after launch, and that's where the disappointing sales come from. And this is where maybe Nintendo of Europe is a bit lacking. They can back a game with all their support and all their might, but sometimes with the marketing of like these third-party games is sometimes really struggle with. The same goes for like Rhythm Thief. I think they released one or two trailers and then released it in April.
Yeah. Well, and sort of disappeared without a trace.
Yeah, I don't think barely anybody in Europe talks about that game anymore, which makes me a bit sad because I really love that game.
Do you see much Nintendo marketing, though, in Europe? Because a lot of the ads, like the Wii U ad, that came out in just the UK.
There are not much, surprisingly enough, there are not much UK or no European Wii U ads on television right now. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's, again, Europe trying to line up at once. But the clock is certainly ticking before that system is going to be released. So I'd certainly hope that they are... going to do something interesting.
Yep, only 20 days now.
20 days, and I'm excited.
Yep.
So, to break this podcast up a little bit, I think we're going to do a call. When calls, guys, you can ask us a question, but we're also going to ask you to Americify a European game name. So we're going to, for example, we're going to say Hydroventure, and you're going to say Fluidity. But of course, you are allowed to ask a question for us before we're going to do that. And you can win something with it. So I hope that Kyle has set someone up for us to have here.
Yeah. So yeah, mainly we thought of this idea because as we were talking about before, one of the amusing quirks of Nintendo of Europe sticking so close to the way Japan does things is that game titles are often different from region to region, and often Europe gets the funniest ones. As I think you'll find, we've got quite a long list here. I think you'll be amused by some of them. Waiting for a call.
We're waiting for a call, but press to join. Well, we should have somebody on the air, but we're waiting for him to join in.
Hello.
And we, hello, oh, Stefan. How are you?
Okay, you?
I'm pretty good. So, do you have a question for us, or are you here for some general chat?
Well, I would do some general chat. I'm on Nintendo Free Radio and all that fun stuff. I was just wondering, in general, does each of the localizations, French, German, UK, English, and everything, do they have their own local treehouse, or is that handled by a central treehouse-like entity in Europe?
That's a very good question. No, it's all handled from their Frankfurt office, basically. So they have this gigantic floor with all these different seats for QA and translation. And the funny part is, I actually went one time like 1.5 years ago to apply for a job there. So I got to see all of that stuff in hand, and it was pretty interesting. But basically, pretty much, they're mostly working in one big team on one gigantic floor together.
Does that ever – I know with Treehouse, they try to make things a little bit more English, like well, I can't think of any good examples off the top of my head. But they, some of the idioms that don't translate over, do you ever get that where they translate something that makes a little bit more sense? You said it was in Germany?
I think
they do translate – so they have the individual translations, and they do put in localized versions of what the sayings or things that might not translate directly.
But I don't think it's to the same extent as Treehouse would. Like you think of,
but no,
for example,
names
like
and things.
Oh, names specifically.
Or for the names of characters and things. Like if there were a pun in Japanese, they'll do a slightly different one in Spanish, in English, that makes sense in that language. Or sometimes they'll just translate it directly, depending on whether it fits at all. So the translations don't stack up like one to one. It is done differently.
I remember a time long ago where in German games in the localization department, they would make like a Link to the Past or and one Zelda game, they make a reference to Pokemon in a Zelda game, and that was unheard in every single country, but Germany went that far in their department. Now it's more structured and more focused, and all of the countries have the same baseline. But there used to be a time where they are even worse than that. So there you go. Would you be interested in winning a prize, Stefan?
Yeah, I would be. What do you got?
So, I'll have some couple of stuff, but it depends if you get your question right. So, I want to hear the American title for 3D Space Tank.
Oh, shoot. I actually know what game this is, too. This is not Kuzo, the one where you put them through the holes, and it's on the eShop.
It's also
on the box.
I cannot remember. I can see the game, but I cannot remember its name.
That's unfortunate. It is Xscape.
Yep, one of the most ridiculous European names I've ever heard for a game.
Well, we have one more, which is more ridiculous. But okay, let's try one more. Walk with me. Do you know your walking routine?
That's the full name of the game.
Yeah. Walk with me. Do you know your walking routine? This sounds like a Nike shoe.
No, it's
an exclamation
mark. Walk with me.
And
then a question mark. But do you know your walking routine?
And then let's catch after this, right? Let's see. Walk with me. Let's see. It wouldn't be Wii Fit.
No.
No. It would be.
It's a Nintendo DS game. I'll give you that.
DS Rain. Let's see. Walk with me.
I'm going to have to call that.
I'm going to have to call it. Yeah.
It's Personal Trainer Walking.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there was a Personal Trainer Walking. I guess somebody's getting some use out of that pedometer or to go through get hats.
You got the pedometer, and you were all traveling on the Zwick World Map online and trying to get through the universe. I'll give you credit for trying, and thank you very much for your call.
Welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, to be perfectly fair, I don't think we can blame anyone if they don't get these, because some of these titles are so asinine that I don't think it'd be so easy to connect the dots sometimes.
It's quite insane, yeah. If you guys want to call in, Please let the guys know, and we will try to bring you in the call. You can ask us a question, and you can try to guess one of these quirky game names.
You see, I always thought they were translating directly from the Japanese, like for the press release. And I remember these games were released in English first before they went to Japan. So it's not that.
Yeah.
So we don't really know why they're picking the names as they are.
Yeah, we determined it was especially the case with download games. It seemed like every single one, like going through a long list of games on WiiWare and DSiWare and the eShop, every single one was different, and often across from all three regions. I don't understand it.
Yeah, for example, the recent examples for as well are like Fall Blocks and Crash Mo. It's like, what's a Mo?
Yeah, in that case, I'd say Europe's got the better name there, because Paul Blocks, it makes much more sense.
I suppose it does.
Going back to what Stephen was saying about what we were telling Stephen about the Frankfurt headquarters, they also run the website out of Frankfurt, don't they? Do you know if they run all the languages from Frankfurt? Because I know in the English writers, they're based in Frankfurt, and they do the whole Nintendo.co.uk from there.
Well, most of the website stuff is actually.
You have a Dutch website. I'm sure you do.
We're getting a call soon. I have to pay attention to two things at once. Sorry, guys. So what? You're multitasking. Incredible. So what is happening at the Frankfurt office is also all the things that are happening on the website, basically, are done in Frankfurt. And it's, you know, I don't know about all the apartments that are happening within Nintendo of Europe. I know about marketing. I know about, marketing, website management, Club Nintendo, and translation. And the local marketing, or getting people interested in their games, or talking with journalists, is done through the local PR in the specific countries. But I'm going to stop talking because we have a call. We have Luca. How are you doing?
Hello again. It's me.
Welcome back, sir.
Hello. Sorry. No one is calling, so here I am. And I'm sorry. I'm trying not to monopolize this thing, but I'm very proud to be in the very first Eurocast. And good work to everybody.
Thank you.
Do you have a question for us, sir?
Yeah, actually, I'm about this Nintendo of Europe thing. I had the opportunity, I think it was right before the Wii was coming out, I had the chance to apply for a job at Nintendo of Europe as a translator and tester. Sadly, in the end, I couldn't go because I had some health problem in my family, very serious stuff, so I had to cancel my move there, and it's my biggest regret in life to this moment. So I wanted to ask, how is it in Großerstein? How is it there? Because I never had the chance to go.
So you want to know how it in the office works there, or...
Yeah, like the people and what they usually do, testers and translators.
Well, they usually look busy, I can tell you that much.
Well, they're in Germany.
Well, yeah.
Everybody's busy there.
I haven't had much time in the headquarters because I was only just there, of course, for like an interview, which, of course, I never got the job, which was sad.
I hear you, man.
Yeah. And also their requirements are insanely high. So if you actually got the job but you had to cancel it, I think you were pretty good. So at least you can give yourself props for that.
Thanks.
But yeah, no problem. But they are very busy in constantly and working on games, but not only in games, unlike the hardware stuff, like the parts of the software. So they are constantly busy, and every single week they have tasks. And if they bring those tasks not to full circle, games could get delayed and delayed badly. So they are very dependent on their translation department. Even the marketing is. So they are very, very important to Nintendo of Europe. But in other news, are you interested in winning a prize, perhaps?
Or does he have a prize already?
Or does he have a prize?
No, I have not. I don't know. Did I miss something? I went out to get dinner, so I sent the email in the first segment, but I don't know. Do you have good news for me? I don't know.
I don't know. Shall we try anyway?
Yeah, whatever. Just for fun. I would crash and burn like usual, so whatever.
Sure. I want to know the American name for Shadow Warriors.
Shadow Warriors? Oh, I don't know.
Give you a clue. It was a Nintendo NES game.
NES? Wow, that goes back.
Another clue, notorious for being very difficult.
Ninja Gaiden?
Yay. You got it correct, sir.
He's got it.
Yes!
Well done.
If you could send me a message later, I will sure we can hook you up with a little prize.
Absolutely, thank you. And it was the difficulty thing that gave it away.
If you would like to give you a good hint, at least a good direction to what to expect, sir.
Yeah, one more thing before I leave. Actually, two things. First, the IRC chat asks to make this Eurocast a thing, so let's make it happen, guys.
Yes, I never mentioned. This is, in fact, the first Eurocast. We've never managed to do one before now with any of the European stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a European podcast in the past, and I will say I am very interested in making it happen again. At least I can see the chat right now, but if there's an audience...
They're all asking for Greg to be on the Eurocast.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then please let me know, and then I will make sure that the talks happen. At least we can talk about it and see where it goes from there.
Yeah, but thank you so much for bringing it up.
I will definitely take it in perception.
All right, and I will bust your balls on Twitter to remind you.
Okay.
and as this is a personal thing, I don't want to sound too romantic on anything, but I want to say, Carly, your voice is amazing, and you have a great accent. I love it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay.
It's actually slightly different to Greg's accent and Tom's accent, despite the fact that we're all from the same country, believe it or not.
Yep.
Yeah, but England is a big country, has a lot of accents, and I really like Greg's, but yours is a little bit more, polished, so to speak, a little bit more clean.
It really does depend which part of the country you're from.
Yeah. I really like the British accent in the every person, every British person I meet. Maybe the Northern accent a bit less, no offense, but the British accent is really, really great.
Well, Sarek, thank you so much for being on here, and I hope you monopolize this thing, because else it's going to be a long day for most people involved.
we'll see at 3 a.m.
Well, but I'd still appreciate it, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me again.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And we have another caller. Jel, are you there?
Hey, how's it going?
I'm good, thank you so much.
You can call me Joe, by the way. J-A-L are my initials.
That's cool. Go ahead, Jill.
Or didn't say it if you know me on the boards.
I'll just call you Jill, for sake.
That's fine.
do you have a question for us?
Yes. I was wondering about, it seems like every time when we're considering whether or not a game will get localized in America, there's always the issue of, how the American culture will respond to how the game handles, violence or issues of sexuality or whatever the culture might object to. So
yeah.
In Europe, where you've got all these many different countries which have their own, cultural approach to all these different subjects. How do they sort of, I mean, how do any games with any objectional content get released at all? You know, like how do they balance that, or what considerations do they weigh, and is it as much of a problem as it seems it should be?
At least in Europe, it's the reason that the European Union works as one in the form of PEGI. Mm. So the PEGI rates, if a game is okay to release in most regions or most countries within Europe, except for Germany. Germany does this on their own with the USK.
It's a lot more strict in Germany.
Yeah, it's a lot more strict, and sometimes games don't get released there. But mostly Europe overall, they seem pretty open about things, both sexual and violence. And it's not like they condone it, but they are more open about things in certain media forms. And
yeah, I think in Western culture in general is more accepting of these kind of things, probably because we've just become conditioned to it. Like in all forms of media, like film,
well,
and games, you know, as well.
You guys in the UK still have your outbursts in the form of which does it again? The Sun?
Yeah.
And we don't see that much in the rest of Europe. Like, nobody calls them out because they just accept how games are. But in the UK, there's still sometimes an outcry about things, and in specific certain instances where they don't agree about the game. And sometimes it's not even rational or not even thought through. So there is certainly people out there who think mildly different and sometimes badly about video games, but they are far and far between. So that's a very interesting... I don't know why this is. I don't know why Europe is more accepting of these things, because I don't play much violent games. That's why I'm mostly a Nintendo fan, you could say. But I don't know the real answer for it. It's a weird thing.
I think the ratings do sometimes skew higher on violent games, though, compared to the US.
Oh, yeah. I think sometimes we get an 18 rating. More or less, but they still get released either way. And most of the gamers have been grown up so much that they actually, it's not a big issue as much anymore.
I know that typically.
Yeah, back in the N64 days, and Perfect Dark wasn't released at all in Germany.
Oh, yeah. I think they corrected it with the XBLA version.
Yes, I think so.
But she wanted to say something, Gio. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I know stereotypically it seems that, like, the American audience is more willing to accept violence, but not so much the sexual content. And I don't know. I was wondering if, you know, I know you mentioned Germany is a little bit more strict.
Yeah.
It's just really amazing and kind of impressive that, you know, there's not, that they don't have to feel they have to please, like, all these individual tastes. That they kind of manage to agree on one baseline for, you know, the whole of the continent.
Yeah, it's hard to say, really. A lot of it, these issues don't really come up with Nintendo games because these sort of themes like violence and sex, they don't really come up.
Is there any game you guys can think of that you didn't get for any of these reasons?
Not really. Like I gave the example before in Paper Mario Thousand Year. It was like in the Japanese version mentioned that Vivian appears like a woman, but is actually a man. Mm. And that's completely removed in America. So it's the subtle stuff. It's not really the big stuff that's that makes a difference. It's more like the smaller things, details in games that are more open and fluid in European software. But it's an interesting point. And thank you for bringing that up.
Gotcha. Thanks, guys.
Do you want to try to win a prize?
I will absolutely lose at this game, yes.
Great. Fantastic. So, I want to know the American name for art style intersect.
Art style intersect. Style savvy.
No, it's art style DigiDrive.
Oh, of course. My favorite game. How could I not know?
It was more of the easier, but unfortunately, we have to let you go and bring up the final caller. But thank you so much for being
again,
with
guys.
Us.
Thank you.
So we now have Eric.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm really enjoying the Eurocast. Basically, a lot of people in the chat think it should be a sort of a regular thing, sort of like the Famicast, maybe.
We hope so. We'll still get the talks, but we have to talk after the Teleton has concluded. Right. Do you have a question for us?
I guess my question was, what is your favorite European exclusive Nintendo game? Meaning one that hasn't been released in North America.
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question.
I'm struggling to think of any instances of that, to be honest.
Well, if you like puzzle games, then Kuru Kuru Kurin on Game Boy Advance, which is actually a launch game, that's not so bad.
Yes, I really like that game.
There was a Hamtaro game on the Game Boy Advance that only released in Europe and not America that I really liked. And Pandora's Tower is a game that I actually enjoy too. So those are the instances that I think that a European version game was a lot of fun.
Yeah, we're being told by Johnny that we should mention Terranigma, but the thing about Europe is we missed out on a lot of the RPGs of the Super Nintendo era, so I've never gotten around to that. Have you guys ever played Terranigma?
No.
No.
I played a little bit through emulator, but that's it.
Because I was young, my English wasn't so good back then, so of course I haven't played it, unfortunately. So, do you have anything else to ask? Because it was kind of a short question.
I can't really think of one right now. I just wanted to get your views on what your favorites were. No votes for Tingle or anything like that, I assume. Yeah.
Tingle is
not a brilliant game. It's fun, but I wouldn't say it's one of the best games on the DS, for example.
Right. Tingle is just a weird game. And if you played like Dylan's Running Western, you know how the game will play out for you, but then in a Tingle fashion, pretty much.
Yeah, I think it's more one of those games that you enjoy, like, more for the irony value, more than anything.
Right, you're more enjoying the theme than anything else.
Yeah.
Indeed.
The fact that the game even exists, yeah.
It's insane that it's even released in Europe. Okay, I'm sorry, I forgot one game that's actually Europe exclusive and not got released in America, and I feel bad for bringing it up, which is the Hotel Dusk sequel.
Oh yeah, of course.
Last Window.
What did you think of that game?
Did I loved
it up to the first one?
Yeah,
I never got into that one as much.
I really loved that
out
game.
Of all of the adventure puzzle games that you have on the DS.
Mm-hmm. No wait. That's giving me a brainwave. There's a couple of other notable ones I've forgotten. One that I have actually played is another code R, which I guess is known as Trace Memory in America, but yeah, that one only came out in Europe and it's pretty good. You know, fairly probably doesn't make quite as good a use of the system as the DS game did. But I quite liked it. Kind of an interesting story. And then another one that I haven't played that I'm sure some people will be happy for us to mention is, of course, Disaster Day of Crisis.
James' favorite game.
Yep.
It's a great game. I will stick with that.
Are you interested in winning a prize, sir?
Sure.
Okay, so let's pick out the most devious one. Professor Layton and Pandora's Box. What's it called in North America?
Have a 1 in 4, 5 chance if you can remember the names of the other games.
Isn't it Professor Layton and the Diabolical Box?
Yeah,
you got it right, sir. Please send me a message after the show and we'll try to hook you up with a little prize.
Sure, well thank you very much.
No problem at all. I think that's also going to wrap up the podcast because we have mostly running full for an hour. So
I'm actually going to hand over on time.
Well, yeah, so I have to thank Derek for being our last call. Thank you so much, Carly, for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Thomas, for your podcasting debut. I hope it went well for you.
Yeah, I feel like it. I've only been on staff for a couple of months now, but it's been a good learning experience. And so finally getting the podcast debut is very nice. So hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Oh, I hope so in the future. And if people are interested, let me know. We'll try to figure something out.
That's going to do it for part one, folks. Come back next time for Radio Trivia, Connectivity's Who Wants to Be a Nintendo Air, and the Famicast.